Saying they were from a recruitment agency.
I'm sharing the real-life stories from the scams I investigate. So you'll see the fraudsters coming before they get you.
I hate myself for falling for this.
The new series of Scam Secrets with me, Shari Vahl, on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds. Starts today at midday.
Good morning. It's 6 o'clock on Thursday, the 13th of November. Hope you are well. This is Today with Justin Webb and Emma Barnett.
The headlines this morning. The US Congress is going to vote next week on a bid to force the release of government files relating to the sex offender Jeffrey Epstein, increasing the political pressure on Donald Trump. And BBC News has been told that the Prime Minister apologised to the Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, for Downing Street briefings against him.
We'll get into that. Also in today's programme, the heartbreaking story of the mother campaigning for schools to have life-saving kits after her 15-year-old son was killed in a knife attack. The artist, David Shrigley, on his aim to make a million by stringing people along.
The starting point was the aphorism, money for old rope, in that you're invited to buy some old rope. And yeah, it's kind of how I make a living.
And
we might be Delulu, but we're trying to save our pub from being knocked down, along with its rich 400-year history.
Our pub has so much riz, and here's why.
Spill the tea!
Right, how a Dorset Village pub was saved after the locals went viral. But first, the BBC News is read by Caroline Nicholls.
The US Congress is set to vote next week on forcing the Department of Justice and the FBI to release files from the investigation into the sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. A petition calling for the move reached a majority in the House of Representatives last night, hours after Democrats released emails written by Epstein referencing Donald Trump. They've acknowledged the messages contained no evidence of wrongdoing. Republicans responded to what they called cherry-picking by releasing more than 23,000 pages of documents, also from Epstein's estate. The White House has accused Democrats of trying to smear the president. Here's our North America editor, Sarah Smith.
The vote in the House of Representatives could trigger the largest Republican rebellion against Donald Trump since he returned to the White House. Already, some of his most loyal supporters have broken with the president on this issue. If the bill passes in the House, it is likely to fail in the Senate and would anyway need to be signed by Donald Trump before it could become law. The president is named in some of the emails that were released yesterday. In one of them, Jeffrey Epstein apparently told his accomplice Ghislaine Maxwell that Donald Trump spent hours at his house with one of Epstein's victims. The woman's name is redacted, but the White House says it is Virginia Giuffre and points to previous comments she has made saying she never saw Mr. Trump doing anything wrong.
The emails also appear to show Andrew Mountbatten Windsor pleading with Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell to make it clear that he was not involved in the allegations against them. In one, the former prince writes, "This has nothing to do with me. I can't take any more of this." Mr. Mountbatten Windsor, who was stripped of his royal titles last month, has always denied any wrongdoing. The longest ever shutdown of the US federal government has ended after President Trump signed into law a bill to restore its funding. The legislation was passed in the House of Representatives last night, with Republicans and Democrats voting largely along party lines. The closure lasted 43 days. Hundreds of thousands of workers went without pay, including air traffic controllers, causing major disruption to flights. President Trump spoke to journalists as he signed the bill in the Oval Office.
I just want to tell you the country has never been in better shape. We went through this short-term disaster with the Democrats because they thought it would be good politically, and it's an honor now to sign this incredible bill and get our country working again.
Sir Keir Starmer has spoken to the Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, to smooth relations after suggestions were spread by those close to the Prime Minister that Mr. Streeting might be eyeing a leadership challenge. Downing Street figures briefed journalists at the BBC and elsewhere, leading Mr. Streeting to claim there was a toxic culture at Number 10. Here's our political correspondent, Damian Grammaticus.
Yesterday, Wes Streeting branded as juvenile and self-defeating nonsense the claim spread by some in Downing Street that he might be considering ousting the Prime Minister. It led to 24 hours of turmoil for the government. And last night, to patch things up, Sir Keir Starmer spoke with his health secretary by telephone. In the brief call, the BBC has been told Sir Keir apologised to Mr Streeting. It's understood the Prime Minister was incandescent about the storm ignited by the anonymous briefings. The Labour Party chair, Anna Turley, said there would be an investigation into who had been responsible and action would be taken.
Anglesey in North Wales has been chosen as the site of the UK's first small-scale nuclear reactors. The government says they'll help to power the equivalent of around 3 million homes. The modular reactors will be built at Wylfa, the site of a decommissioned nuclear power station. Here's our Wales correspondent, Howell Griffith.
A decade after the old Wylfa power plant closed its doors, this rural corner of North Wales is now being heralded as the future of nuclear power in the UK. Initially, three modular reactors, designed by Rolls-Royce, will be assembled on the site, with the aim of bringing them into use by the mid-2030s. That timescale is quicker than the construction of traditional, larger plants, which the government says it also wants to see built. A search for new sites has also been announced.
New research shows that the world's use of coal, oil and gas this year will release more carbon dioxide than ever before. The study from a team of more than 130 scientists shows that emissions from fossil fuels will rise by just over 1%. But the research also shows the growth of carbon output has slowed over the past decade as renewable energy has taken off. A senior MP has called for an investigation after BBC News revealed that two hospitals had continued to use a heart device despite knowing of concerns that it had a higher mortality rate than a rival product. Leading clinicians at both hospitals, the Freeman in Newcastle and Harefield in London, were paid consultants for the manufacture of the mechanical pump. More details from our correspondent, Michael Buchanan.
The hospitals continued to use the mechanical heart pump after an NHS audit had shown its mortality rate over a nearly two-year period was three times higher than a rival product. A subsequent analysis of those who'd received the device after the concerns had been raised showed that patients died at a higher rate than for the other pump. The two men who led the transplant centres at the Freeman and Harefield hospitals had also been paid consultants for the device's manufacturer for a decade. Leila Moran, who chairs the Health Select Committee, said she was deeply concerned and urged the General Medical Council to investigate. Both hospitals say they were aware the cardiologists had a role with the pump's makers, that this was common practice and that they believed at the time there had been no clear clinical grounds to stop using the device. They say they also had questioned the NHS data. The pump was later withdrawn on safety grounds by the manufacturer.
Treasure finds in England, Wales and Northern Ireland have hit a record high. Provisional government figures show more than 1,500 discoveries last year. Among the more unusual items unearthed are a Roman lamp shaped like a human foot and a scoop for removing earwax.
Thank you for that. 7 minutes past six. Let's have a go at the weather. Raise our eyes to, I suppose, the skies, possibly beyond, with Simon King, who is there at the BBC Weather Centre. Morning, Simon.
Yeah, hello, Justin. Good morning. We've got some rain in the forecast, and actually, I need to just highlight tomorrow because it's going to be especially wet across England and Wales, heavy and persistent rain, as it is pretty wet this morning across some northern areas of the UK. But further south, in southeast and southwest England, it's a largely dry morning, and there'll be some sunny spells for much of the morning, but the cloud is going to thicken up this afternoon, and there some rain gradually moving its way in during the afternoon. Maximum temperatures getting up to about 13 to 16 degrees. So still really quite mild for the time of year. For Wales, the Midlands and eastern England, a couple of showers around across Wales at the moment. Those will fade away. There'll be some clear spells for many of us. So lots of sunshine, actually, and that'll continue into the afternoon. Highs of 11 to 16 Celsius. Now, it's across northern England, where we've got a bit of a split. In the far north, rain is still lingering on here. And that is likely to continue into the afternoon. But further south across northern England, there'll be some brighter spells, bit of sunshine in southern areas. Just for a time, though, because the cloud will start to increase later again this afternoon. Highs of 10 to 15 Celsius. Now, it's Northern Ireland, central and southern Scotland, where it's a very wet start to the day. Some heavy rain around. And that's going to continue really for much of the day. If anything, it might turn a bit lighter, a bit patchier later this afternoon. Highs of 6 to 9 Celsius. And for northern Scotland, scattered showers, but some brighter sunny spells, especially later on, with maximum temperatures of 6 to 9 degrees.
Simon, thanks very much. And at 9 minutes past six, let's have our first look at the headlines and the morning papers and go into those stories in a bit more detail. The Times reports that cabinet ministers are demanding the sacking of the number 10 chief of staff, Morgan McSweeney, because of what the paper calls vicious Downing Street briefings against the health secretary. The Daily Telegraph leads on Wes Streeting's response when he called the briefings toxic and juvenile. Sir Keir Starmer's allies have warned that ousting him could trigger a general election. That's according to the Daily Mail. The leader column in The Sun says Downing Street is in the grip of suicidal paranoia and the government has exploded into civil war.
The Daily Mirror leads on the release of emails related to Jeffrey Epstein in the US, pictures of Donald Trump with the late sex offender at Mar-a-Lago in 1997. The Financial Times quotes one email apparently written by Epstein in 2015 to a New York Times reporter asking if they would like photos of Donald and girls in bikinis in my kitchen. Epstein messages pile pressure on Trump is the headline for The Guardian. It highlights the president's claim that the Democrats are trying to distract from their role in the federal government shutdown.
The BBC is preparing to apologise formally to President Trump over last year's misleading Panorama edit. That's according to the Daily Telegraph. The paper says lawyers at the corporation are working on the wording of the BBC's response. Sources tell the iPaper that the BBC believes it could win a court battle if Mr. Trump carries out his threat to sue for $1 billion, but they are said to fear that an angry president could destroy its US ambitions.
Many of the papers pick up on an analysis of Adolf Hitler's DNA that's been the subject of a Channel 4 documentary. The Times has a grisly memento taken from his Berlin bunker, a blood-stained piece of sofa fabric, has revealed he had Kallmann syndrome, which is a genetic disorder that hinders the typical progression of puberty and sexual development. As the Telegraph puts it, scientists believe the wartime song about Hitler and his henchmen was correct. He did only have one ball and possibly a micropenis to boot.
I joined the programme just to hear you say those words, Justin Webb. What an extraordinary last sentence of a newspaper review. It's 11 minutes past six.
The future of nuclear power is unveiled today at a site in Anglesey. Hal Griffiths, our Wales correspondent, is there. What are we going to be told, Hal?
Good morning, Justin. Yes, well, it's big news for Ynys Môn or Anglesey, where I am today. Big news for Wales, for the UK, according to the UK government. We'll see, I think, quite a few ministers here today to herald what they're calling a new nuclear age. Why? Well, Anglesey's been chosen as the host for these new small modular reactors. We've heard a lot about since that announcement back in June that £2.5 billion was being put in by the UK government to invest in new nuclear. Now, Anglesey is familiar with nuclear industry. There was a plant here built in the 60s, finally decommissioned a decade ago. Now we'll host three of these new modular reactors. They're different because they're smaller. Some argue they're not that small, but they can be factory built off-site, designed by Rolls-Royce, and then assembled together here in a much faster, potentially cheaper way than conventional, slow and expensive nuclear plant production. They should be brought online then by the mid-2030s, and it's claimed their combined capacity will be 1.5 gigawatts, or enough for the equivalent around 3 million homes. Now, that announcement is another announcement to expect by the UK government today, that they're also looking for other sites for new conventional big nuclear power stations. So that will be announced today, and we should get the answer to that location in about a year's time. However, someone in Anglesey felt that could have come its way too. Obviously, there is an old decommissioned site that would be prime for that. And no less than the US Ambassador Warren Stevens had been lobbying for Anglesey to be chosen for a bigger nuclear plant. He's actually disappointed by today's news, saying that they could have put spades in the ground here to come up with a cheaper, faster solution.
Yeah, and that would have been an American company, presumably. That would have been an American company, presumably, doing it, which is why he's so upset. We're going to hear from Ed Miliband, the Energy Secretary at quarter past eight or so. Is there a sense then that you're picking up that locally, as well as with the US ambassador, that there is annoyance that actually this isn't a bigger announcement in a sense than what it is?
I think on Anglesey, people are waiting to see the reality of when spades hit the ground. Since the old Wilver station closed a decade ago, there's been lots of discussion. False dawns, arguably. There was a plan with the company Hitachi to build a new plant there that came to nothing eventually in 2021. So cautious welcome. It does obviously not bring new energy, not just new energy, but new employment prospects. And in terms of the Welsh Labour government, it's being sold as a huge win. Now, the timing of this announcement, it takes a long time to make these decisions. However, politically, Welsh Labour really needed a win to show voters here ahead of the next election in May, considering, of course, its recent problems in the Caerphilly by-election and its poor showing in the polls. So we'll see the First Minister, Lynette Morgan, as part of this announcement today, claiming a big win, showing this is proof that a Labour Welsh government and a Westminster Labour government working together can produce employment prospects. Of course, okay. Opposition parties will question how many jobs will actually come and how quickly they'll come, given promises in the past.
Hal Griffith, thank you.
It's 14 minutes past six. Two of the UK's leading transplant centres continued fitting a heart device despite knowing it had a higher mortality rate than a rival product. That's what a BBC investigation has found. But why? Why did this happen? Why did it continue to happen? Michael Buchanan is the BBC Social Affairs correspondent. Morning, Michael.
Good morning.
To that question, what do we know?
This is centred on a heart pump made by a company called Medtronic, and it's fitted in patients who have got severe heart conditions and need help to pump the blood around their bodies. Now, in 2018, there was an emerging concerns internationally about this pump and its effectiveness in comparison to a pump made by a separate company, so much so that the Papworth Hospital in Cambridge decided to move away from it and move to the better performing pump. Now, certainly by the spring of 2019, the NHS itself sent round an audit it had conducted of patients using the two pumps, and it had found that over a two-year period, the mortality rate for this Medtronic pump was three times higher than the other pump. But as you said, two hospitals, the Freeman in Newcastle and Harefield in London, they continued to use this pump. A subsequent analysis of the 80 patients that received it showed that 39 of them had died within the subsequent 3 years. Now, when we started looking into what had happened and why this had happened, we found out that the two consultants, the two cardiologists who led the Freeman Transplant Centre and the centre in Harefield, were paid consultants for Medtronic and had been for a decade. Medtronic eventually withdrew this particular pump from sale in June of 2021 in the interests of patient safety.
So they had a commercial link with the provider?
They had a commercial link with the provider. Now, when we spoke to the consultants concerned and the hospitals, we got quite lengthy statements. The hospitals say that they were aware their staff had roles with the company. They said that such practices are common across the NHS and can be beneficial to patients, as they can actually improve devices in certain circumstances. The two hospitals as well say there was no clear grounds to stop using the device and that they had questioned the NHS data back in the day. One of the consultants, Professor Stefan Schuller in Newcastle, he did respond to us, and he told us quite clearly that in his statement that there would never a financial incentive for him to choose one device over another, and that they'd continue to use this device after internal discussions, and that they had concluded it was better for their patients. The other consultant, the man who used to work in London, Dr. Andre Simon, he did not respond to any of our questions at all, and he has left the hospital and left the NHS. And as I said, Medtronic, the device makers themselves, they withdrew this pump from sale in 2021 because of significant problems with it, and in their statement said that was essentially because of patient safety concerns.
Michael Buchanan, BBC Social Affairs correspondent. Thank you.
18 minutes past six. More now on those plans for nuclear on Anglesey. Small nuclear, not big nuclear, but still nuclear. Sean is here with that and the rest of the business news. Morning, Sean.
Yeah, morning, Justin. Some interesting questions raised by your discussion with Hal a little earlier about this project backed by £2.5 billion worth of investment from the UK government. It's going to be built by the publicly owned Great British Energy Nuclear, and Simon Bowen is the chair there. Simon, morning. Thank you for joining us. We heard Hal say how, as an example, the US ambassador to Britain wasn't happy that this wasn't a traditional large power station. It would be cheaper, he says, to be able to build it and have many other benefits besides. Why don't you agree?
Good morning, Sean, and thanks very much for having us on. I think the government's invested a huge amount in Sizewell, and we've invested a significant amount so far in the Small Modular Reactor program. So we do believe in both large scale and small scale. But for now, we believe that the right solution for the nuclear program is to put small modular reactors at Wilver, and it's a milestone decision for us moving forward, and we're delighted that we've got what is the best characterised site in the UK. That doesn't, however, mean that we're not going to look at future gigawatt reactors, because they all fit in the mix, and with the degree of nuclear that's required in a balanced grid that has, you know, a stable grid that can give us energy security and the journey to lower bills and net zero, then you have to have all of these technologies. So it's not exclusive, and it's not never, it's just not now.
Can I ask you about Great British Energy Nuclear, the organisation that will be the publicly owned organisation that will be building this? You don't have a chief executive at the moment. Why is that the case?
We have signed contracts for a chief executive, and the new chief executive will join us in early next year. Gwen Parry-Jones, our previous chief executive, we'd agreed that she would leave the organisation in September to go back into the Nuclear Decommissioning Authority. And we have interim arrangements in place where a number of us are supporting the executive team. So, it's seamless between now and when the new chief executive arrives. We've got a very talented executive team that are on with progressing the project. And we've made the great progress we have as a result of the talent we've managed to attract. So the fact that we haven't got a chief executive for a couple of months is not an issue.
Okay, because people in the region, as we were hearing from Hal in Wilver and on Anglesey more widely, they will have seen cost issues in the past leading to failures of promises of new nuclear power on the site. Why, given the setup at the minute, is this going to be any different?
I think the Great British Energy Nuclear was established because of the market failings of the past. So Hitachi got to a point where commercially they just couldn't make the deal work. The reason that we set up Great British Energy Nuclear was because we recognise that these programmes are very, very high-cost programmes, and they take a long time. And the only organisations that can take that first-of-a-kind risk need to be backed by government. So the government backing is a massively important part of this. We've secured the 2.6 billion through to for this spending round to get on with the design work. And government fully understands that, you know, we are aiming to get private sector investment in at the end of this period for a final investment decision. In the way that Sizewell have been very successful, we expect that to be successful. The first of a kind will be a difficult build, because they always are when they're first of kind.
And so the risk is being taken a little bit by Wilver here. There is a risk, isn't there, that this won't work? This isn't as tried as tested technology as other more traditional plants.
It is not the case that it won't work. This is traditional technology, which is well proven. It is the build methodology that we need to get right. And that's the reason for building three and then going on likely to a fleet of eight at Wilver, is that once you've proven the first one, once you've got the modular factory set up, then you can roll them out on a much quicker basis than you can with the gigawatt scale. So you can get electricity on the bars quicker with small modular reactors, but you've got to take the time to understand how to build them economically, and that's why you need to build them in fleets.
Simon, thank you. Simon Bowen, their chair for Great British Energy Nuclear. Now, the boss of British Gas, the British Gas owner, Centrica, says it's unlikely that the green energy will provide as many jobs in the North Sea as oil and gas has. I've been speaking to Chris O'Shea for the latest episode of the Big Boss Interview podcast, available on BBC Sounds Now. I asked him what effect the race to decarbonise this energy network by 2030 was having on Scotland in particular.
The demise of the North Sea, I think, has been understated at the moment. And I think that the impact... I lived in Aberdeen for a few years. I'm not from there, but I lived there for a few years in the 90s. I think the demise of the North Sea, is the impact has not yet fully been felt. And I think that we're not creating enough jobs in offshore wind or in other areas, and or having the skills passports as quickly as we could in order to offset that. So I think we've got to be really careful. And it's one of the things that, it's one of the great parts of my job, is creating jobs. And I think that, you know, you look at growth, what we've really got to do is to look at how to create jobs. We've taken on about 1,700 apprentices in the last 4 or 5 years. We've committed to taking on one every day for this decade, at least. I mean, these are well-paid jobs, and you give people a career. I remember what it was like when I got my job when I was coming out of university. It was quite hard for me to get a job, actually. I got loads of rejection letters, and I was quite late on in getting a job. A lot of my classmates had jobs in like the October, November, December before graduating. I got mine in April, I think, at the end of April, start of May. So I know what it's like to be a bit worried about getting a job. I also know what it's like, though, to get a job that you like and that you find out that you're good at. It can change your life. It certainly did for me. And I love doing that. So I worry about the impact in Aberdeen specifically. But I'm also very excited about the ability to create new jobs for the energy transition. The energy transition is the right thing for us to do. It's essential. It's not cheap and it's not easy. If it was cheap and easy, we'd have done it already. It's not cheap and it's not easy. But the quality of the jobs that we can create if we get this right is quite breathtaking. I think often people are in agreement about what needs to happen. What the area of disagreement is the pace at which it needs to happen. And I think we've got to be a bit more cognizant of the pace. So we've got to make sure that we don't simply say the destination is here, let's get there as quickly as we can. I think we all agree on the destination. Then the question is, what's the optimal way to get there? Mm. We've got to make sure that we create jobs. I grew up in a town of Fife, which was surrounded by coal mines. I saw the devastation when the coal mines were closed during the miners' strike, and people that had incredibly well-paid jobs, they went to no work at all. And you've got second, third generation people that are not in work now. And I desperately want to avoid that through this transition. That's why we're creating a lot of jobs at Centrica.
Because of the nature of these jobs, you may say creating higher paid jobs, do we need to accept that there won't be as many high paid jobs in, for example, the region in and around Aberdeen as there would have been with the North Sea and oil and gas was in its heyday?
I think it's hard to say. I suspect you're right. I suspect there won't be the same quantum of jobs, the same number of jobs as when it was in its heyday. But, you know, economies evolve. And, you know, we're going through a revolution just now, like, we saw the Industrial Revolution before. There will be fundamental change. The point I'm making is that we can't simply make these changes and just assume the market will take care of it. We have to be thoughtful about the impact on people, the demographics, where people stay, will people have to move, where do you site businesses, etc. And be thoughtful and think about how we incentivise companies to go. And so if you've got a great skilled workforce in Aberdeen, they can do a lot of this work. Aberdeen might not be the natural place for you to set up a new energy transition business. But if you've got the workers there, and this is where it comes down to a policy question, it might well be better to try and incentivise businesses to go and be based in Aberdeen rather than to try and get all of the workers to move from Aberdeen to Manchester or Liverpool or something. So, but I think we'll see fundamental change. I think we'll see more energy. We are seeing more energy centres coming up. And, for example, the reason I use Manchester and Liverpool is that both of these places are doing a fantastic job. Both mayors, Steve Rothermere and Andy Burnham, are doing a great job of bringing in business there. But these are emerging as new net zero clean energy and powerhouses. So I think they'll sit alongside Aberdeen. But we just might want to incentivise some more companies to go to Aberdeen to use the talent that's there. But we have to be thoughtful. We have to make sure that we don't leave people behind. We have a just transition.
Chris O'Shea, Chief Executive of Centrica, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks very much, Sean. Thank you.
You can hear much more from Chris O'Shea, including why he believes more energy companies may well go bust. Energy suppliers, you can search for the Big Boss interview on BBC Sounds. Anna McDonald joins me now, investment manager at Aubrey Capital Management. Anna, continuing the energy theme, SSE announced huge energy investment plans yesterday. Share price was up. I mean, investors confident about how they're raising this money and the returns they'll get on it.
Yeah, they are confident. The shares rose 16%, which is a pretty incredible magnum. And the investors like the fact that they're investing even more in the grid. And that means that they get some nice predictable returns from that grid investment. They're doing the rapid expansion of renewables that Chris was just talking about means that we need to produce more grid to be able to get that energy to where it needs to go, rather than having to pay producers that to produce energy like wind energy and not actually be able to transmit it back to the grid.
And can I ask you about the housing industry, the housing market, Anna? Because the report out this morning from estate agents, chartered surveyors, saying there's been a notable cooling off of the housing market recently. Taylor Wimpey yesterday, big house builder, said it's seen sales fall, needs to be more demand. What can get this going if that is what we want?
Well, demand is partly to do with confidence. It's partly to do with affordability. And whilst interest rates have started to come down, I think that there is still quite a concern about just the level of pricing. And it's a bit of a chicken and egg scenario. We need more houses built. But in order to get more houses built, you need to have the demand there. So we wait for a budget that hopefully won't do anything to lead to increases in inflation, because that makes it harder for the Bank of England to cut rates.
Anna, good to talk to you this morning. Anna McDonald, Investment Manager at Aubrey Capital Management. I'll be back after 7 o'clock.
You will indeed. Thanks very much for that, Sean. Interesting as always, as will be Mike, who's here with the sport. Hi, Mike.
Thank you, Emma. Yes, no pressure. Shall we start with football? Well, I'll tell you who did impress last night. Manchester United, 3 wins from 3 for them in the Women's Champions League. A crowd of over 14,500 people at Old Trafford watched them beat Paris Saint-Germain by 2-1. More from Ailey Barber.
Women's Champions League football at Old Trafford for the first time, and Manchester United were not overawed by the history they were making under the lights. An assured, mature performance against the two-time finalists ensured they maintained their 100% start. And it was their French striker who broke the deadlock, Melvin Mallard getting the better of Mbok to slide the ball past Mary Earps on her return to Manchester. Olga Carmona drew things level with a stunning strike on half-time, but United, primarily through the hugely influential Jess Park, were the most dangerous. And when Fridolina Rolfo headed them back in front, there was only going to be one winner. 9 points from 9 for United. They go joint top of the table on a significant night for the club.
Meanwhile, the Women's Champions League holders, Arsenal, have left themselves with work to do after a second defeat in 3 matches. They threw away a 2-goal lead in Germany as Bayern Munich beat them 3-2. Away from football now, this is exciting. Let's head to Australia, where we can bring you the first live cricket of the 2025 Men's Ashes Tour. Not the first test, of course, still got 8 days to wait for that. But England's one and only warm-up match has got underway in Perth overnight. They are playing a 3-day match against their development side, England Lions. And the BBC's chief cricket writer, Stefan Schemmelt, is there for us live. Morning, Steph.
Morning, Mike. How are you doing?
Yeah, we're okay. So the Ashes Tour is officially underway after what feels like months of build-up. Tell us, what's happening? Bring us the latest on this match.
Well, the Lions are 181 for 5. We're just moving towards tee on the first day. Now, there's a question of whether or not that score matters, but performances do at this stage of the tour. And yet again, it's the performance of the England captain, Ben Stokes, that stands out. He's playing for the first time since July because of a shoulder injury. He's taken 4 wickets, all very similar, batters playing pull shots. And just like he was in the summer, he's England's main wicket-taking threat. More good news for England, Mark Wood has got through 2 bowling since February after knee surgery. Jofra Archer looks lively. 50 for the Lions for Ben McKinney and Jordan Cox, 2 England prospects. No spinner for England. That's a hint towards their first test plans. And the pitch is achingly slow, a world away from what they'll face at Optus Stadium in that first test, and maybe vindication for that one warm-up match plan.
And just briefly, Stefan, you mentioned Ben Stokes. I guess he's glad to just finally get the ball in hand and play some cricket, because he has copped a bit of flack, hasn't he, in the last 24 hours following his comments yesterday where he dismissed the views of ex-players, calling them, quote, has-beens.
Yeah, and a lot has been made of what Ben Stokes said, and I think it was a little bit of a throwaway line. But England do feel that they have got their preparations right, and I think they are being vindicated here because of the conditions that they've got at Lilac Hill. This isn't really like a test match pitch, and they would say, well, do you want us to play 2 or 3 more games like this? What are we getting out of that? So I think at the moment they'll be happy with their plan and what they've got out of today.
As we have takeoff in Perth, takeoff for this Ashes series. Not a test match pitch, as Stefan was saying. Not a test match technical setup either, clearly. Apologies for the few glitches on that line. Hopefully, try and smooth those out when we hear from Stefan later in the programme. And a reminder, the first Ashes test starts a week tomorrow. The countdown is on.
Mike, thank you. Here is a question might put you off your breakfast.
Have you ever eaten a cockroach?
No, but I considered that if I did, it would taste like an aubergine.
That cake blew my mind.
Jay Rayner opens the door on a new series of The Kitchen Cabinet.
Life is too short.
Yes.
To peel a pineapple.
Joined each week by an expert panel assembled to answer all your food and cooking questions.
I have much cream and I do not see it as a treat. I see it as an absolute necessity.
The Kitchen Cabinet with Jay Rayner.
This isn't really just a food question. This is also relationship advice.
Returns on Saturday morning at 10:30 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
Yum, yum, hubba, hubba.
Life is too short to peel a pineapple. Now the time is 26 minutes to 7. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Justin Webb and Emma Barnett. And now we have a summary of the news for you from Caroline Nichols.
The US Congress is set to vote next week on forcing the government to release files related to the investigation into the sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. A petition calling for the move reached a majority last night, hours after Democrats released three emails written by Epstein referencing Donald Trump. One suggests Mr. Trump spent hours with one of Epstein's victims. The White House says this was Virginia Giuffre, who never accused Mr. Trump of any wrongdoing. It says the Democrats are pushing a fake narrative. President Trump has signed a bill to end the 43-day shutdown of the US government after it was passed by the House of Representatives. Welcoming the breakthrough, he criticised the Democrats and said there should never be another shutdown. Democrats had been refusing to reopen government unless Mr. Trump agreed to extend health insurance subsidies. But several broke ranks to vote with the Republican Party. It was the longest government shutdown in US history and saw hundreds of thousands of government workers going without pay. The Prime Minister has spoken to the Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, to smooth relations after suggestions were spread that Mr. Streeting might be eyeing a leadership challenge. Allies of Sir Keir Starmer had briefed the press, indicating the Prime Minister would resist any coup attempt. Sir Keir condemned the briefings, calling them unacceptable. A BBC investigation has revealed that two hospitals continued to use a heart device despite knowing of concerns that it had a higher mortality rate than a rival product. Leading clinicians at both hospitals, the Freeman in Newcastle and Harefield in London, were paid consultants for the manufacture of the mechanical pump. The hospitals said they were aware of their role, but this was common practice and that they believed at the time there had been no clear clinical grounds to stop using the device. Anglesey in North Wales has been chosen as the location for the UK's first small-scale nuclear reactors. The government says construction of the site at Wilfer will support up to 3,000 jobs in the local community.
Caroline, thank you. It's 24 minutes to 7. There are calls being reported in the Times newspaper today for the sacking of the Prime Minister's most senior aide, his chief of staff, Morgan McSweeney, after a day of vicious press briefings against the Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, who was accused of plotting to remove Sir Keir Starmer from office. Henry Zeffman's our BBC chief political correspondent. Henry, should we know Morgan's name, Morgan McSweeney's name? Should his name be out there like this? Why does this matter?
Well, it matters because the government has been plunged into a state of chaos over the last few days. I mean, just to slightly recap, yesterday we had a situation where the government's designated interviewee across the media of the morning, Wes Streeting, the health secretary, was across the airwaves, variously accusing those at the top of government of a toxic culture, of sexism, and calling for unnamed officials in Downing Street to be sacked. And it's that last one that people across the Labour Party, including in the Cabinet, have taken up. And for some of them, that does mean Morgan McSweeney, the Prime Minister's chief of staff. He's become a lightning rod for criticism, not just within the Labour Party, but you also had Kemi Badenoch asking questions about him at PMQs yesterday. Now, as you heard in that news bulletin, the Prime Minister and the Health Secretary spoke on the phone yesterday evening in an attempt to patch things up. We're told that Keir Starmer apologised to Wes Streeting in the brief call and they agreed to talk in further detail soon. They did not actually talk about Morgan McSweeney specifically. And yesterday, Wes Streeting actually conspicuously praised him, saying that the Labour Party would not be in government without him.
What do you think this shows us about how Downing Street is operating? Because that's what matters to you know, citizens of this country.
Well, fundamentally, the Prime Minister has changed his top team in Downing Street in quite a few ways, quite a few times. Certainly quite a few times by the standards of someone who's been in Downing Street as relatively briefly as he has. Morgan McSweeney's been by his side throughout his leadership and throughout his time as Prime Minister, but he didn't start Keir Starmer's stint in office as Chief of Staff. That, of course, was Sue Gray, now Baroness Gray of Tottenham. And in none of the iterations of Downing Street staffs that he's had have senior Labour people, including cabinet ministers, been quite happy with how things have worked. That is why as we have reported, and as was advertised yesterday by Keir Starmer's own loyalists with devastatingly counterproductive effect, his leadership is under threat.
Is that real? The threat?
Yeah, very much so. And, you know, there is a question about the imminence of it, and that is why it's so, you know, strange to so many people who remain supportive of Keir Starmer, and many do, that those around him, or some of those around him, decided to take what is a conversation that's happening furtively in corridors and corners of Westminster and has been happening for months, and turn it into a public conversation. Because, you know, that seal only really gets broken once under any prime minister of any party, and it has now been broken, and it's been broken by Keir Starmer's own loyalists.
Henry Seffman, we'll come back to this story. BBC's chief political correspondent. Thank you.
We will indeed, with Ed Miliband at 8:15 or so. Time now is 21 minutes to 7. Another tranche of Epstein-related emails was released overnight. They include Jeffrey Epstein telling someone that Andrew, then Prince Andrew, had been photographed with Virginia Giuffre. Sean Daly is our North America reporter. I've been asking him what exactly has been released.
Well, we've got around 23,000 emails in the public domain now that weren't sort of 24 hours ago. And it all started off with the Democrat members of the House Oversight Committee releasing these three key emails, some of which obviously mentioning very specifics about Donald Trump. No specific allegation, it has to be said. But Jeffrey Epstein, the convicted sex offender, pointing back in 2011 to the fact that he was surprised that Donald Trump had not previously been named, and also suggesting that he'd spent time with Virginia Giuffre for hours on end. There are other emails with the author Michael Wolff, who's written several books about Donald Trump. And again, sort of just back and forth emails. In one of them, there's talk about Donald Trump being asked about their friendship, or, you know, visiting the house and the plane during a CNN interview. And there's another email in 2019 when Donald Trump had first been elected as US president, sort of implying on the part of Jeffrey Epstein that he knew about, as he, to use the expression, the girls, but he'd asked for that via Ghislaine Maxwell to stop. But it's not clear what was meant by that.
What happens next, Sean? Are we expecting now, because of a political change within the House of Representatives, that we're actually going to see much more of this?
Yeah, it seems quite likely. I mean, it's almost been weaponized to a degree with Democrat members of the Oversight Committee releasing what could be seen as at least interesting emails mentioning Donald Trump, and then the Republican members of the Republican-led Oversight Committee releasing sort of well over 20,000 documents. But it's a discussion that will absolutely continue.
Sean Daly in Washington, thank you.
It's 19 minutes to 7.
The Gaza peace plan's next step goes to the UN Security Council. There are also developments this morning in the opening up of humanitarian aid into Gaza. Let's talk to Yolande Nell, the BBC's Middle East correspondent, who joins us from Jerusalem. The aid corridors, first of all, what can you tell us, Yolande?
Well, we have this announcement coming from the Israeli body that controls the crossings into Gaza just yesterday, that it was now going to reopen the Zakim crossing into the north of the Gaza Strip. This has been closed for 2 months now, so no supplies have gone directly into the north, despite the great need there. And people went back after the ceasefire, but the crossing was not opened at that point. So UN officials have basically welcomed that Israeli decision. And they've spoken too, though, about how still, in their humanitarian work, they are being hampered in their ability to distribute food. Once it arrives inside Gaza, they're having to stretch out the available stocks, the UN spokesperson said. They was also UNICEF saying this week that the demand for baby formula far exceeds the current supply. And, you know, still so much to be working on. The UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres came out and said that the Gaza ceasefire in general was fragile. It was repeatedly violated, but it is holding.
Right. Now, on that, we then turn to the next step, don't we, which is where the Security Council potentially comes in. Interesting to see whether there could be any agreement on that. But wait, basically what we're talking about now, or what they're going to be talking about, is what? It's security and a longer term future for Gaza.
Yeah, in particular, this International Stabilisation Force for Gaza, they want to get a mandate for that from the UN Security Council. And local media here have been really picking through comments made by the US Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, in Canada, where he was at the G7 talks. There are sources being quoted here saying a vote could happen at the Security Council in the next few days. Marco Rubio was sounding positive, saying we're making good progress on the language of the resolution. Hopefully we'll have action on it very soon. But, you know, it's obvious that the US is still having difficulties convincing countries to contribute troops to this. Of course, the concern of many is that they're going to be sending soldiers into a war zone, potentially, where, you know, they would have to still use force to disarm Hamas. Now, the draft of a resolution that's been circulating in the media, we don't know how up to date it is because it's not confirmed, but it does talk about this International Stabilisation Force stabilising the security environment in Gaza by ensuring the process of demilitarising the Gaza Strip. It talks about, you know, destruction of military, terror and offensive infrastructure, as well as permanent decommissioning of weapons from non-state armed groups. And we have already got a number of Arab countries, the United Arab Emirates, the Jordanians, Israel's ruled out Turkey taking part in this force, but countries are not at the moment, you know, committing their troops, according to other reports in the Israeli media, quoting unnamed Israeli defense officials. So this is an ongoing issue and a very sensitive one.
Gilan now in Jerusalem. Thank you.
At 6:45, let's return to British politics. Sir Keir Starmer has told MPs he has never authorised attacks on his cabinet ministers and that briefings against them were unacceptable. But the Conservative leader, Kemi Badenoch, as Henry was mentioning, said the Prime Minister, in Prime Minister's Questions, had lost control of his government and lost the trust of the British people. They clashed at PMQs after speculation about a possible Labour leadership challenge. David Cornock reports.
Lincoln Jopp is a former army colonel who won the Military Cross. With all this talk of leadership plots, the Conservative MP thought his experience might come in useful for an embattled Prime Minister.
I particularly remember in 1997 in West Africa where I somehow managed to survive a bloody and violent attempted coup. So if the Prime Minister wants any ideas about how to do that, he only has to ask.
Sir Keir Starmer did his best to look amused. The Conservative leader, Kemi Badenoch, had also been keeping up with the news about the alleged leadership ambitions of Wes Streeting.
This morning on the BBC, the Health Secretary said there is a toxic culture in Downing Street that needs to change. He's right, isn't he?
Mr. Speaker, my focus each and every day is on rebuilding and renewing our country. But let me be absolutely clear, any attack on any member of my cabinet is completely unacceptable.
The leadership speculation was said to have come from allies of the Prime Minister. Wes Streeting wasn't in the Commons to hear his boss praise his work.
And today the Health Secretary is in Manchester where he's announcing that because of the action he's taken to abolish NHS England, he's putting more people on the front line. He's doing a great job, as is the whole of my cabinet.
Kemi Badenoch thought there was only one waiting list Wes Streeting wanted to cut.
But the Prime Minister is not going to do anything about the toxic culture. This is his responsibility. Just last night, his allies accused not just the Health Secretary, but the Home Secretary and even the Energy Secretary of launching leadership bids.
The Prime Minister appeared mystified by the source of the briefings.
Of course, Mr. Speaker, I've never authorised attacks on Cabinet members. I appointed them to their post because they're the best people to carry out their jobs.
The backbench cheering on both sides was starting to bother the Speaker.
If people want to audition for a pantomime, I suggest you go to the Old Vic.
Well, it is almost that time of year. The two leaders resumed combat, with Kemi Badenoch calling for spending cuts and listing the government's failings.
Taxes set to rise even further. Unemployment at levels not seen since lockdown. And in the middle of it, a weak Prime Minister at war with his own cabinet. Yeah. Mr. Speaker, it's not just him, it is all of them. There is no replacement, it is all of them. 2 weeks before the budget, isn't it the case that this Prime Minister has lost control of his government, he's lost the confidence of his party and lost the trust of the British people? Yeah.
Mr. Speaker, the stupid mistakes were made over 14 long years. They broke the economy and now they think that they can lecture us. And now they've got this unserious idea that they can find £47 billion of cuts without saying where they're going to come from. No wonder that's called flimsy. Meanwhile, we're rebuilding the country. Wages up, investment up, mortgages down.
The Liberal Democrat leader, Sir Ed Davey, used his questions to defend the BBC and attack Donald Trump, who's threatened to sue the corporation over the way his speech was edited for a Panorama documentary.
Will the Prime Minister tell President Trump to drop his demand for a $1 billion settlement from the BBC? And will he guarantee that President Trump will not get a single penny from British licence fee payers?
Keir Starmer was careful not to mention the president, but he told the Lib Dem leader he did believe in a strong, independent BBC. The Reform UK leader, Nigel Farage, focused on asylum hotels. He said the Reform-led West Northamptonshire Council would be applying to close three of them.
In response to grave public concern about the safety of women and girls on the streets of West Northamptonshire, would the Prime Minister approve of us speeding up the closure of the migrant hotels?
Yeah.
Mr Speaker, we will grip the mess we inherited and close every hotel.
After almost half an hour of questions about crime, the economy and political plots, Labour's Jill German tried to cheer up the Prime Minister.
With miles of golden sand and a bucket full of memories, Rhyl has been attracting visitors for generations. Yeah.
She wondered if Keir Starmer would care to
join me for a stroll on our new promenade to see just what Rhyl has to offer.
Yeah. Well, that's a very appealing invitation just at the moment. Mr Speaker.
The Prime Minister mentally packing his bucket and spade for a trip to the golden sands of North Wales, although it can be a little bracing at this time of year.
David Cornut reporting on Yesterday in Parliament brings us to 10 to 7.
For more than a year, there's been a battle in Ukraine to keep the key eastern city, Pokrovsk, from falling to Russian forces. And now that battle could be lost, especially as difficult weather conditions take hold. The city is being overrun and there are videos showing Russian soldiers entering in a Mad Max style, as it's been described. Francis Farrell is a reporter at the Kyiv Independent. Good morning.
Good morning.
Why is this city so key? Let's start with that.
Well, Pokrovsk is one of the so-called fortress cities in Ukraine's eastern Donbas region, one of these areas where Russia's advance, Russia's attempt to overrun this region, which is one of the key political aims of their war of conquest as it continues. And this is where Russia has been stopped in its tracks for over a year, really trying at first to surround the city by the west and then by the north, and now trying to assault it head on, infiltrating through Ukrainian defenses. And now it does look like it's truly the final hour for this city, but it has done its job holding back Russian offensives and grinding up basically huge amounts of Russian resources with over probably tens, if not hundreds of thousands of casualties over the past year and countless equipment with it.
What happens if it falls, as it seems like it might?
Well, it's just another roadblock for Russia's offensive to go forward. There are still other cities like it in Donbass. Russia is still very, very far away from taking all of Donbass, which Putin likes to talk about, which he likes to say that it's almost there. Ukraine's defense is very overstretched at the moment. And so it's going to be a really big challenge for them to consolidate their lines of the defense after withdrawing from Pokrovsk. But the first thing for that to happen is an actual orderly withdrawal from Pokrovsk and the neighboring city of Mirnohrad itself. And that's something that, unfortunately, the Ukrainian command consistently leaves to the very last minute if they do order at all.
And strategically, is that an error? Is that how it's seen?
Well, I mean, we saw this before in really big battles like Bakhmut and Avdiivka, also in the Donbass region. And every time, you know, the more these Russian pincers kind of close in on both sides, the less favorable of an attritional fight it is to still stay inside that pocket. But still, you know, even if it's at the last minute, once those Ukrainian forces withdraw, they've managed to make it out. The problem with Pokrovsk is that now the battlefield is so much more saturated by Russian strike drones in the air that even for months now, getting in and out of the existing pocket has been extremely deadly. Vehicles cannot make it in and out, so the soldiers are going by foot. And now it could be the case that we do see an actual encirclement. It's not the case yet. It's not been closed yet. And the Russians have been releasing these AI-generated videos of Ukrainians surrendering en masse, which shows that it's not actually happening in real life. But that is the threat. And if the Russians are able to complete a full encirclement, it will be a big propaganda victory for them.
Francis Farrell, thank you for putting us in the picture. A reporter there at Kyiv Independent.
6 minutes to 7 is the time. The world's biggest report into carbon emissions is out. The report is annual. It includes scientists from around the world, among them Professor Corinne Le Carré, who is the Royal Society Research Professor at the University of East Anglia School of Environmental Science. Morning to you, Professor.
Morning.
What are the headlines?
So, unfortunately, the fossil emissions rise again this year. We had been hoping to be close to a peak emissions, but we're not yet there. The patterns are quite different. It's not China in India, as it is usually, because extraordinary growth in renewable energy in those countries are really starting to pay off. But we have a global rise in energy demand. We have the US emissions are going up, possibly also Europe, because of a cold winter and other factors. So we're not yet there, unfortunately.
And the overall picture then, in terms of the curve that you see, you say we're not at a peak yet. Can you see where that peak might come?
We can't make projection at this stage, but what we are seeing is that we've been sort of flat or increasing a little bit in emissions. That's a very different picture from 10 years ago, where the emissions were rising very fast. What's happening in China is very interesting because they're investing massively. 10% of their GDP is on clean technology. So they are now able to match their rise in global energy demand almost completely from renewable energy. But so in the coming years, we should start to see a turnaround in those region, but we're not yet there.
Do the COP talks make a difference? Because we've got the 30th going on at the moment. What some critics of it say, you know, you go all the way to Brazil this time round and they put a road through a bit of rainforest and all the rest of it. And actually, it's a great jamboree that really doesn't make a lot of difference to the bottom line, which is what they say they're trying to achieve, which is what you're looking at, which is a reduction in overall emissions.
Yeah, they absolutely do make a difference. There's a lot of evolution in what's going on now. We have 35 countries that are able to decrease their emissions for over a decade while growing their economy. The UK is one of them. And we also see progress on deforestation, and that's not negligible. Because that's another big aspect causing climate change. So the COP in Brazil this year is going to be able to make progress on a lot of elements. Signaling is a big deal, especially with the U.S. Retracting from the Paris Agreement, the fact that the other countries will hopefully state at the end of this conference that they're continuing in tackling climate change, because not only it's good for the planet, but it's also clean energy. Electricity is clean energy. It's versatile, it's efficient, and it's really the economy of tomorrow.
Professor Corinne Le Carré from the University of East Anglia, thank you.
A Radio 4 tradition is on the horizon.
This is a call for a revolution.
A revolution.
A revolution of decency, in which anyone can participate. A revolution of hope that can shape the world.
Shape the world.
My name is Rutger Breckman. I'm a historian, an author, and I am calling for a moral revolution. The 2025 Reef Lectures, coming soon to Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
Weather time now. Here's Simon King.
Justin, thanks so much indeed. Rain features really quite heavily in the forecast over the next couple of days. It could lead on to some
actual localised flooding problems in some parts. We'll get on to that in just a second. But for southeast and southwest England, it's a dry morning with some sunny spells are actually for much of this morning. The cloud is going to thicken, though, through this afternoon with some rain gradually moving in later on this afternoon and highs of 13 to 16 degrees. For Wales, the Midlands and eastern England, we've still got a couple of showers across Wales, but those will clear away. And actually through the day, there'll be lots of sunshine with maximum temperatures getting up to about 11 to 16 Celsius. Across northern England, still some rain lingering on in the far north, and that's going to continue, I think, for much of the day, perhaps just easing off slightly later on. But there will be some brighter or sunnier spells in southern areas of northern England for a time before the cloud increases again during the afternoon and highs of 10 to 15 degrees. But it's for Northern Ireland, central and southern Scotland, where we've really got a very wet start to the day, some heavy rain out there, and the rain is going to continue pretty much all day. It may well turn a bit lighter, a bit more patchy later on, and temperatures of 6 to 9 Celsius. And for northern Scotland, well, scattered showers, but some bright or sunny spells, especially later on, with highs of 6 to 9 degrees. Now, through tonight, that rain coming into southern England will spread further northward into Wales, the Midlands and eastern England by early Friday. The wind will pick up as well. It's going to be colder across Scotland, though, with some colder air moving through. Temperatures tonight down to about -3 to -5 Celsius with some clear skies. But during Friday, heavy and persistent rain across most of England and Wales. Could be some localised flooding, especially across parts of South Wales, the South Midlands, towards eastern England. It's quite a strong wind as well. Drier further north, though.
Simon, thank you. You're listening to Today with Justin Webb and Emma Barnett.
It's 7 o'clock on Thursday, the 13th of November. The headlines this morning. The US Congress is to vote next week to force the Trump administration to release remaining files on Jeffrey Epstein. President Trump has accused his opponents of using a hoax to smear him. BBC News has been told that the Prime Minister has apologised to the Health Secretary Wes Streeting for briefings against him by Number 10. And Anglesey in North Wales has been chosen to host the UK's first small nuclear reactors.
Coming up in the next hour on this programme, so do stay with us. What is really going on behind the scenes at Number 10? We will speak to the former Labour spinners, those spin doctors, directors of communications, to give them their former full titles, Alistair Campbell, Tom Baldwin. Also,
that whole little corner here is all Hitler's blood. The American soldier just took out a knife, cut a piece off, put it in his pocket, and off he went. They didn't think 80 years later people were going to try to extract DNA off of it.
No, they did not. And unluckily for you, we'll tell you all about it. A new analysis of Hitler's DNA has revealed a hidden genetic disorder. The scientist who led the research will be on the programme. And would you pay £1 million for a load of old rope?
It seems quite a lot of money.
£1 million? Well, by weight, Colin, you know, you've got 10 tonnes of contemporary art. And by weight, I think it represents excellent value.
Really? We'll find out. The BBC News is read by Caroline Nichols.
The US Congress is set to vote next week on forcing the Department of Justice and the FBI to release files from the investigation into the sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. A petition calling for the move reached a majority in the House of Representatives last night, hours after Democrats released emails written by Epstein referencing Donald Trump. They've acknowledged the messages contain no evidence of wrongdoing. Republicans responded to what they called cherry-picking by releasing more than 23,000 pages of documents, also from Epstein's estate. The White House has accused Democrats of trying to smear the president. Here's our North America editor, Sarah Smith.
The vote in the House of Representatives could trigger the largest Republican rebellion against Donald Trump since he returned to the White House. Already, some of his most loyal supporters have broken with the president on this issue. If the bill passes in the House, it is likely to fail in the Senate and would anyway need to be signed by Donald Trump before it could become law. The president is named in some of the emails that were released yesterday. In one of them, Jeffrey Epstein apparently told his accomplice Ghislaine Maxwell that Donald Trump spent hours at his house with one of Epstein's victims. The woman's name is redacted, but the White House says it is Virginia Giuffre and points to previous comments she has made saying she never saw Mr. Trump doing anything wrong. In another 2019 email, Epstein said, "Mr. Trump came to my house many times and never got a massage." Yet the continuing release of information linking Donald Trump to the late sex offender further increases the political pressure on him to publish all the information the government holds on Jeffrey Epstein.
The The emails also appear to show Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor pleading with Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell to make clear that he was not involved in the allegations against them. Our UK correspondent Adina Campbell reports.
In one of the email chains, Jeffrey Epstein appears to confirm a photograph of the former prince with Virginia Giuffre as being real, adding that several of his staff had their picture taken with Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor. In a separate email, Andrew writes, "This has nothing to do with me. I can't take any more of this." Later saying, "Please make sure that every statement or legal letter states clearly that I am not involved and that I knew and know nothing about any of these allegations." Virginia Giuffre says she was forced to have sex with Andrew 3 times, a claim he continues to strongly deny.
The longest ever shutdown of the US federal government has ended after President Trump signed into law a bill to restore its funding. The legislation was passed in the House of Representatives last night, with Republicans and Democrats voting largely along party lines. Our correspondent Sean Dilley reports from Washington.
President Trump said the agreement means the federal government can resume normal operations. The 43-day shutdown was triggered by the minority Democrats after Congress failed to reach a deal to extend funding for health care subsidies for millions of Americans. Even now, funding is still due to expire at the end of December, with Democrats promised to vote on future health care funding before then. California's Governor Gavin Newsom called the deal pathetic and a surrender. But the deal means most federal departments will be funded into the new year and thousands of government employees will return to work and receive back pay.
The Office for National Statistics has just released figures showing the UK economy grew by 0.1% between July and September. The figure for the previous quarter, April to June, was 0.3%. Sir Keir Starmer has spoken to the Health Secretary Wes Streeting to smooth relations after suggestions were spread by those close to the Prime Minister that Mr Streeting might be eyeing a leadership challenge. Downing Street figures briefed journalists at the BBC and elsewhere, leading Mr Streeting to claim there was a toxic culture at Number 10. Here's our political correspondent Damian Grammaticus.
Yesterday, Wes Streeting branded as juvenile and self-defeating nonsense the claim spread by some in Downing Street that he might be considering ousting the Prime Minister. It led to 24 hours of turmoil for the government. And last night, to patch things up, Sir Keir Starmer spoke with his health secretary by telephone. In the brief call, the BBC has been told Sir Keir apologised to Mr Streeting. It's understood the Prime Minister was incandescent about the storm ignited by the anonymous briefings. The Labour Party chair, Anna Turley, said there would be an investigation into who had been responsible and action would be taken. The aim of those who'd stoked the suggestion the Prime Minister might be facing a challenge from within was, it seems, to convey that this would be a dangerous course for the party and be met with defiance from Sir Keir. But it left Downing Street having to douse the fires set from within and has shone a light on the deep unease within Labour at the dire poll ratings both the party and its leader face.
A senior MP has called for an investigation after BBC News revealed that 2 hospitals had continued to use a heart device despite knowing of concerns that it had a higher mortality rate than a rival product. Leading clinicians at both hospitals, the Freeman in Newcastle and Harefield in London, were paid consultants for the manufacture of the mechanical pump. More details from our correspondent Michael Buchanan.
The hospitals continued to use the mechanical heart pump after an NHS audit had shown its mortality rate over a nearly 2-year period was 3 times higher than a rival product. A subsequent analysis of those who'd received the device after the concerns had been raised showed that patients died at a higher rate than for the other pump. The 2 men who led the transplant centres at the Freeman and Harefield hospitals had also been paid consultants for the device's manufacturer for a decade. Leila Moran, who chairs the Health Select Committee, said she was deeply concerned and urged the General Medical Council to investigate. Both hospitals say they were aware the cardiologists had a role with the pump's makers, that this was common practice and that they believed at the time there had been no clear clinical grounds to stop using the device. They say they also had questioned the NHS data. The pump was later withdrawn on safety grounds by the manufacturer.
Anglesey in North Wales has been chosen as the site of the UK's first small-scale nuclear reactors. The government says they'll help power the equivalent of around 3 million homes. The modular reactors will be built at Wylfa, the site of a decommissioned nuclear power station. Here's our Wales correspondent, Howell Griffith.
A decade after the old Wylfa power plant closed its doors, this rural corner of North Wales is now being heralded as the future of nuclear power in the UK. Initially, three modular reactors, designed by Rolls-Royce, will be assembled on the site, with the aim of bringing them into use by the mid-2030s. That timescale is quicker than the construction of traditional, larger plants, which the government says it also wants to see built. A search for new sites has also been announced.
Scientists in Exeter say they've discovered why type 1 diabetes is more severe when it develops in young children. The autoimmune disease is caused by the body attacking cells in the pancreas. Our health and science correspondent James Gallagher has more.
Children, particularly those under the age of 7, seem to develop more aggressive type 1 diabetes than those diagnosed later in life. Researchers at the University of Exeter studied pancreas samples from 250 donors, allowing them to see how the beta cells, which produce the hormone insulin, formed normally and in type 1. They showed early in life the beta cells live in small clusters, which are easy for the immune system to pick off and destroy. Later, they mature into larger clusters, which are more durable and allow patients to still produce low levels of insulin. The researchers say it's a really significant finding and that the future was looking much brighter with drugs that can slow the immune system's attack.
James Gallagher reporting.
Thank you for that. 9 minutes past seven is the time. How close are we to getting the full picture of what Jeffrey Epstein did, and more importantly, who the powerful men were who abused women and girls alongside him? Another tranche of emails was released overnight. Republicans in the US House of Representatives responding to earlier releases by Democrats on a key committee. And behind the scenes, still talk of a vote in which the House, including some Republicans, formally calls on Donald Trump's Justice Department to release everything it has. That vote expected to come next week. In one of the emails released overnight, Andrew Mountbatten Windsor tells Epstein and Maxwell, "I can't take any more of this." I've been talking to Spencer Coovin, who's a lawyer who's represented several victims of Jeffrey Epstein. I asked him about the newly released emails, and one in particular, which appears to confirm that the picture of the former Prince Andrew with his arm around Virginia Giuffre is real, something that he had previously denied.
I don't think there are many people currently today that believe the story that Andrew originally told, which was that he didn't recognize the photograph, didn't think it was real. This shows and confirms again that not only does the world think it's real, but Epstein himself thought it was real. In addition, I think that some of the emails, or at least one of them, show that there is this connection that exists between Donald Trump, Jeffrey Epstein, and Andrew. I think that it enlightens us into that further group of connections that Ghislaine Maxwell was putting together over the years.
The emails do suggest, don't they, relationships, mainly that we already knew existed, but simply confirm that they existed. Do they go, in your view, any further than that?
I think that they do go a little bit further as it relates to Donald Trump and some of the information that may come out in the near future. I have repeatedly demanded and requested that the House Oversight Committee make sure that the FBI releases all photographic evidence as well as videotape evidence, because I think that will further enlighten the general public as to who was at Epstein's homes and what was going on at those homes. And these emails tend to suggest a much deeper connection that Donald Trump may have had with Jeffrey Epstein at the time.
There is a specific email which mentions Donald Trump being alone with a girl in an Epstein property. The White House says that was Virginia Giuffre, and that there's no suggestion that Mr. Trump behaved improperly. And that is true, isn't it?
What is true is that Virginia Giuffre testified that she did not witness Donald Trump do anything inappropriately. What we don't know is the name that was redacted. All we know is that the current administration claims that that was Virginia's name underneath the redaction. But right now, we don't know that to be true. Until I see it from myself, I do not trust, frankly, what anyone says at this point. We need the evidence. We need to see all the evidence and have it independently looked at to determine whether what they're saying is true or not.
That was Spencer Coovin. Worth saying, President Trump still denying any wrongdoing in relation to Epstein. Andrew Mountbatten Windsor also always denying wrongdoing and hasn't faced any charges either. I've been talking to our North America editor, Sarah Smith, in the light of that conversation that you've just heard about the pressure building on the Trump administration to release all of the files.
Pressure is building on the White House, definitely, to release the files. And it comes in a number of different ways. The White House press secretary was asked about these files being released, and she complained that it had been done deliberately to distract from the fact that the government shutdown had ended, which Donald Trump thinks is a win for the White House. And the complaint was that was being overshadowed by the Epstein emails. That just shows you how incredibly easy it is for the administration to be thrown off course yet again when more Jeffrey Epstein information is revealed. This keeps happening. It keeps distracting them and changing the narrative that they want to tell. There is the lingering suspicion that one of the reasons that Donald Trump doesn't want to release all of these files is because there is some kind of information in there that would be embarrassing to him. Now, the White House says that that's absolutely not true. And we haven't seen anything yet that suggests any wrongdoing from Donald Trump. But the longer they resist publishing these emails, the more that suspicion builds. But probably the biggest problem that the administration has is the number of Republicans who are starting to rebel against this. Now, it took four Republican members of the House of Representatives to sign a discharge petition that would force a vote on releasing the Epstein files. But when that vote happens next week, there's likely to be a much, much bigger Republican rebellion. People who have not voted against Donald Trump yet during this administration think on this one particular issue, it's so important that they will defy the president and vote for him to release the files. That won't compel him to do so, but it shows you once there is a split in his MAGA coalition, that's what's really difficult to manage politically.
Why do they feel so strongly about it?
The Republican representative who co-sponsored the discharge position, the mechanism that will force a vote, Ro Khanna, said tonight, this is about rich and powerful men abusing young girls. That is exactly the sort of thing that Donald Trump and his lieutenants were campaigning on, saying this is what the deep state and the elite are trying to conceal from you. This is exactly the kind of thing that's been going on in governments and the upper echelons of society that we will not only stop, but we will reveal to you. And now there is this sense that Donald Trump is part of a conspiracy to conceal the names of people who would be embarrassed by the release of the Epstein files. And it seems to go against one of the kind of central tenets that his MAGA coalition believed in. They feel let down by Donald Trump over this, and it is something they're prepared to take a stand on.
If Donald Trump refuses to release everything, is there a mechanism? Are there mechanisms by which other people can leak material? Because we've already got quite a lot of material, haven't we, including in recent days, out in the public domain that we didn't know was going to be there. So I suppose the question is, are there other ways in which people will get essentially to the same place?
Leaks are always possible, obviously, but the government files that Donald Trump is refusing to release are held by the Justice Department. And that is very much run by Donald Trump loyalists at the moment. And the kind of people who might have been tempted to do this and people who were not necessarily absolutely signed up to the Trump agenda have largely been sacked from the Justice Department, to be honest. So, of course, there is always the chance that somebody will put something in the public domain. That seems less likely now than it would have been in other circumstances. And even if there is a vote in the House of Representatives next week to release the files, that's very unlikely to pass the Senate. And in fact, it would even need Donald Trump's signature on that piece of legislation to force him to do it. So he's got a veto on that one. But people will keep trying. It's more likely to be political pressure and the constant distraction of Jeffrey Epstein that may eventually force them to release these files rather than it being a legislative mechanism. But you're absolutely right, Justin. Every time we think we've seen everything that there is to see or that will ever be released, more and more emails, communications, documents are find their way into the public domain. And that's not something that's likely to stop.
Sarah Smith, thank you.
It's 17 minutes past seven. Figures have just been released show that the economy grew by 0.1% between July and September, less than what had been expected, and a slower growth compared to last quarter. Darshini David, Deputy Economics Editor for the BBC, is here with all of that good news. Darshini.
Yes, morning, Emma. Sorry to bring you yet more slightly disappointing news, but, you know, the government tells us growth is its number one mission. And when you look at these figures, it really underlines there's a way to go before they can say mission accomplished, because what we've got here is not just weaker numbers than expected. If you take away population growth, then frankly, the economy stalled over the summer. There was no improvement. Now, there is clearly an impact here from that shutdown we saw at JLR and that cyber attack. Car production, motor production overall, falling by almost 29% in September.
So that the hacking of Jaguar Land Rover, that would be enough to change this?
It's extraordinary, isn't it? It's not enough on its own, but it's definitely had an impact in that month, and it had a clear impact on all the people, all the workers who are connected with that, clearly. But if you strip that away, there is a genuine slowdown picture going on here. If you look at construction, if you look at services, those two have shown slower growth. And those are the sectors we talk about, aren't they? When we talk about the impact of national insurance, higher minimum wages, they're the ones, retail, hospitality, construction, which are most likely to have seen their costs increase and to be struggling somewhat. And there's also some evidence here as well that, you know, consumers are holding back because they're nervous about this year's budget. So when we hear the Chancellor talking about growth and boosting growth, this is a challenge for her, right? She's got to stand up in just under 2 weeks and give us this budget and say, look, I'm going to find a way of boosting your confidence, make sure that firms are investing and sort of investing in jobs and consumers are out there spending, because incomes are growing quite fast at the moment, in actual fact. But at the same time, she's going to be taking billions of pounds out of the economy and out of pockets in tax rises. So it's quite a tricky challenge to see how they're going to change this and turn it around in the short term.
You talk about consumer confidence, but just in terms of any more reason we could know about growth slowing in this way at this point, beyond, you know, the hacking and some general trends, is there anything about the UK specifically?
Well, it's, you know, this has been a few years. The last 15 years, we've grown at a fraction of what's happened in the period before that. And a lot of economists have pointed to a lack of investment, be it public investment, be it private investment. There's been all sorts of things. You know, the government's been talking explicitly about Brexit, and economists have been doing this for years and saying all of that really damaged our ability to grow more quickly. And we're still reaping the consequences of that, so to speak. We talk about, obviously, President Trump's trade wars and the rest of it. That actually has had a pretty minimal impact on our performance at the moment. You know, as I say, incomes are growing quite quickly at the moment, but what we're seeing is that consumers are feeling a little bit hesitant. Nobody's quite sure why. Are we worried about, you know, big emergency bills? Are we worried about what's in the budget or keeping our jobs even as unemployment rises? But the big key is, can we tap them up to actually spend more of that cash? That'll get short-term things moving again. Longer term, the government has got all these plans, but they take time to actually reap the benefits.
Darshini David. There was a few bright spots in there, our Deputy Economics Editor, you did. Thank you.
We'll be talking to Howard Davis, former chair of the NatWest Bank, in half an hour or so's time. Right now, though, the boss of British Gas, or at least its owner, Centrica, says a fully clean energy system may mean higher bills for households. Funny, we were always told that clean energy equaled lower bills. Perhaps not. Here's Sean.
Yeah, all depends what you're comparing to, doesn't it? Clean Power 2030, the government's plan for the UK to generate enough low-carbon electricity to meet its total demand within 5 years. When I was chatting to the Centrica chief executive, Chris O'Shea, he told me there's a risk we'll end up with an energy system that is 100% clean, but that nobody can afford. Chris O'Shea also saying prices unlikely to ever return to the levels they were at before Russia invaded Ukraine.
The energy crisis, which was provoked by the Russian invasion of Ukraine, has basically dissipated. It's gone. But what people don't tell you is that energy prices had doubled in the run-up to the invasion of Ukraine. And so the long-run average energy prices in the UK, we're not back to there just now. And I'm not sure that we will go back to there. And the reason that they doubled is because the demand is going up and the supply is not going up, at least in the UK. And therefore, energy bills are higher just now. They're actually slightly lower than they were prior to the Russian invasion of Ukraine, but they're higher than they were in the past. So we need a lot of wind, we need a lot of solar, we need a lot of nuclear, and we need a lot of gas-fired generation. And a lot of people tell you that wind power is 9-10 times cheaper than gas-fired generation, but the reality is consumers don't pay the wholesale price. Consumers pay the price on the market plus the thing called the contracts or difference, the CFD price that these producers are given. So what I'll do is I'll give out the facts to people. Now, that's not always popular, But I think it's super important that we're honest with people. And we do need more wind. We do need more solar. And I think the push for clean power is exactly the right push. But what we've got to make sure is that as we do that, we don't end up with an energy system that's unaffordable. Because if we've got a 100% clean energy system and nobody can afford it, that will be a complete and utter failure. By the same token, if you have an energy system that's spewing out a huge amount of carbon, but it's very affordable, that will be a failure. You've got to get this balance right between cleaning the energy system, but making sure that the energy is affordable.
Do you think the government has us on a path to that sustainable and affordable energy system right now, when you hear how it talks about renewables and green investment and net zero?
We've got this clean power 2030 push, and that is unbelievably ambitious. And I'm not 100% sure that we'll get there. But I am 100% sure that we'll get further by having this really, really stretching target. We're not granting you North Sea licences. And the question is that the right thing or not? What you'll find is that with more wind and more solar, more things that are sold in these contracts for differences, these are fixed prices. Effectively, you're fixing the price for the consumer. So you don't have the price volatility that you saw with the Russian invasion of Ukraine. That will not come back, or it will be far more subdued. But the prices might be a bit higher.
You can hear plenty more from Chris O'Shea if you search for Big Boss Interview on BBC Sounds.
Sean, we will. Thank you for that. It's 24 minutes past seven.
Adolf Hitler suffered, it seemed, from a genetic disorder that stunted normal puberty. Researchers have extracted his DNA from a swatch of fabric with Hitler's blood from the sofa on which he killed himself, as they reveal in a Channel 4 documentary.
This is the swatch, and this is the blood stain. That whole little corner here is all Hitler's blood. The American soldier just took out a knife, cut a piece off, put it in his pocket, and off he went. He didn't think a lot about it. He didn't think 80 years later people were going to try to extract DNA off of it.
Let's talk to Professor Terry King, who was director of the Milner Center for Evolution at the University of Bath and actually led the research for the documentary. Professor, good morning.
Good morning.
I suppose the first question is, how certain can you be? Because there would have been other blood and other samples around the place. Are you absolutely sure, 100%, this is Hitler's blood, Hitler's DNA?
Well, that was my very first question as well when I was approached to take part in the project. And this is where you use both kind of non-genetic evidence. So where is this swatch from? What's the provenance of it? What do we know about its history? Does it look right? So if you look at the swatch and then you look at the sofa on which Hitler killed himself, you know, the fabric's very distinctive and it looks the same. You do the genetic research in various labs. We had a perfect DNA match for the Y chromosome matching a known relative. And then you have to ask yourself, okay, how common is this Y chromosome type? It's incredibly rare. You don't find it in the forensic Y chromosome database. And then you ask, so how likely is it that another male line relative of Hitler would have got himself into the bunker after the war and then bled on the sofa? And once you put all of that evidence together, yes, we can be very confident that this is the blood of Hitler.
Right. And it tells you what?
Well, so we're at pains to talk about what it can and cannot tell you. So I have some wonderful colleagues at the Pasteur Institute who found that he has a deletion in a gene which we know is strongly associated with a condition known as Kallmann syndrome, which is characterized by low testosterone levels, by abnormal development of the sexual organs, and in 5 to 10% of cases, a micropenis. Now, we cannot say for certain about the state of his genitalia. And I can't believe I'm now on national radio talking about this. But there are historical documents which talk about him having right-sided cryptorchidism, so an undescended testicle, and rumors about him having underdeveloped genitalia. So it's really lovely where you marry the genetics with the history. And then the second thing is a wonderful team at Aarhus University who do a lot of psychiatric genetics. And they do what's known as a polygenic score. And this is where you take individuals with a particular condition and you go, right, what genetic variants have these people got that these people over here who don't have the condition, they don't have? And then what you can do is you can look at somebody's DNA, you can place them on that particular spectrum. And he's in the top 1% for schizophrenia, autism, and bipolar. And we are at pains to say this does not mean that he had any of those conditions. It is not diagnostic. But it is, of course, fascinating, given who this individual is, that he does have that genetic predisposition towards those conditions.
But can you say then with complete certainty that he wouldn't have had anything like a normal sex life?
Well, this is where the genetics can only take you so far. And this is where we've had a wonderful historian, Alex Kay, who's been involved to go through the historical documentation. And it's always been conjectured that he probably didn't have a normal sex life. The thinking is that he may never have had kind of have normal sexual relationships with a woman at all.
There's another rumor, another complete myth, but I think this one you have been much more certain about, that he was in some way, shape or form of himself of Jewish descent.
So he wasn't. So the question has always been about Hitler's grandfather, where there was a rumor that went around because Hitler's father was illegitimate and there wasn't a father's name on the birth certificate originally. It was always thought that his father was actually a Heidler. But there was this question as to whether or not he was actually. The fact that we have a genetic match between the blood and a known male line relative shows that Hitler was part of the Hitler family, and that lays to rest that rumor about the Jewish grandfather.
I can remember chanting at school, I don't know quite why, Hitler has only got one ball, the other is in the Albert Hall. And I mean, it's odd, isn't it, how there was, and I suppose it came initially from what, soldiers in the First World War, people had been around him all the time, this kind of sense that there was something peculiar, unusual about him, which was being used by people to laugh at him, at least behind his back, even if they never managed to do what would have been a great thing and stop him in his tracks.
Yes. Yeah. No, and this it was a bit of a gasp moment, because when my lovely colleagues at the Pasteur said he's got this deletion, it's incredibly well known, well characterized. It's rare, but known. Of course, that was a gasp moment, because you do have these rumors and, you know, documentary evidence. So the Landsberg prison where Hitler is after he tries to kind of overthrow the government talks about him having right-sided cryptorchidism. So that's an undescended testicle. So you're right. I mean, of course, I love it when you can kind of marry the genetics with the history and give us a broader picture of who this individual was.
Okay, and the broad picture itself, Hitler's DNA, Blueprint of a Dictator. It's on Channel 4, 9 o'clock on Saturday. Professor Turi King, thank you.
I bet you never thought you were going to be reliving that chant on Radio 4's Today programme, but there you go.
You do never know.
You do never know. It's 7:30. Follow that, Mike.
That is the beauty of this programme. You never know what you're going to follow. I'm not sure I can.
No, you can't, but you can try.
No, we'll talk cricket instead, shall we, and head back to Perth, because the Men's Ashes Tour is officially underway. England's one and only warm-up match began overnight. They are playing a three-day game against their development side, England Lions, and Stefan Schemmelt is watching for us live and can bring us the latest.
Yeah, the Lions are 212 for 5, Mike. There's good news and bad news for England. Ben Stokes has taken 4 wickets in his first action since July. He's bowled 2 spells of 6 overs. But Mark Wood, who's bowled 2 spells of 4 overs, it's his first cricket since February, we're told he's feeling some tightness in his hamstring and he'll have a scan tomorrow. England will wait for the results of that. They chose to field, getting overs in the legs before the first test next Friday. Slow pitch, nothing like what they were face at Optus Stadium when they meet Australia. Lions 212 for 5 at the beginning of the evening session.
All right, Stefan Schemmelt live in Perth. Many thanks. Let's stay with cricket now and head inside the England Lions camp and hear from a former player now making a big impact as a coach. Sarah Taylor was once described as the best wicketkeeper in international cricket, men's or women's, by the Aussie great Adam Gilchrist. She was asked by the Lions head coach Andrew Flintoff to join his backroom team last year. And I've been talking to Sarah about how she found the transition from playing to coaching.
I always said as a player that coaching was not my future, but it happened to fall into my lap in a bit of an accidental way. And, you know, I've absolutely loved it. I've been really lucky enough to be surrounded by ex-international players that are now coaches, and I've tried to absorb it and learn as much as I can from them. It has been tough at times. You struggle to sit on the sidelines because you can't affect the game in any way whatsoever sometimes, but I'm continuing to learn that process.
What was it that surprised you pleasantly about coaching? What were your reservations that you might have had about it that maybe stopped you going in initially?
I think it was I'd had a career in cricket, so I wasn't looking to then have another career in cricket. But actually my love for the game sort of pulled me back in, and who was I kidding? I was always probably going to stick around in cricket. So, and I'm glad I did. I'm absolutely glad I did. I'm genuinely loving it.
And there has never been a female coach at this high a level of the England men's game. Do you think you bring a fresh perspective to the side?
Ultimately, I just want to do the best that I can do, especially with the keeping side of things. Enjoyed working with the boys. They just call me coach, which is actually very, very nice. They probably don't realise that, but when a player just calls you coach, you kind of feel part of the system and just another one of the coaches.
And I know you credit Andrew Flintoff and are thankful to him for the opportunity given to you. You were one of his first appointments when he took over coaching the Lions. How is it working with Andrew Flintoff?
It's so hard to describe. He's such an inspirational human being. When he talks in changing rooms and when he talks to the team, no one wants to follow him because his words are so magical and so inspirational, and he'd probably hate me saying that. He just brings a love and enjoyment of the game and wants to make it fun for the boys, and will always try and get the best out of every single player in his own special way. We all want to follow him, and that is the magic. That is Freddie Flintoff, right? We want to follow him wherever he goes, and that's what he brings to this team.
And presumably you hope that your coaching career, wherever it takes you, however long it lasts, can lay the foundations, the paving stones, if you like, for more female elite coaches to come into the men's game.
I will not be the last. I'd like to think that the guys playing nowadays are extremely accepting of coaches and knowledge that come in, whether they're male or female. So there is plenty of opportunities. I'd like to think going forward that female coaches can come into the men's game and succeed. Their knowledge is no different to any male coach. The way I've been received, I can't say I've had a bad experience. So I would willingly open doors for a lot of female coaches to say, please give it a go and back yourself and be confident that you will be received extremely well.
Great chatting to Sarah Taylor, wicketkeeping coach with the England Lions. And away from cricket, briefly, football. 3 wins from 3 for Manchester United in the Women's Champions League as they beat Paris Saint-Germain 2-1 at Old Trafford last night. But the holders, Arsenal, blew a 2-goal lead as they lost 3-2 away to Bayern Munich. And just finally, World Cup qualifying. One match to keep an eye out for later. It's not England-Serbia at Wembley. We've talked before about how this tournament is allowing lesser heralded footballing nations to qualify. Look out for this one. Iraq play the first leg of a playoff with the UAE at 4 p.m. today. Second leg is next week in Basra. If Iraq can win that tie, they will progress to the Intercontinental Playoff next March, where they could qualify for the World Cup for only the second time in their history. 1986, the last time Iraq were at a World Cup.
Mike, thank you for that. We have a star-studded drama coming up later today.
On BBC Radio 4.
My name is Rupert Everett, and I'm playing one of my great heroes, Dennis Rake, in a fantastic new play, Smoke and Mirrors.
You won the Military Cross.
Yes, because I kept going and I didn't die. No more, no less.
An aging drag performer reflects on his secret wartime past.
I knew exactly who Max Halder was the moment he opened his mouth.
Inspired by real events.
He smiled at me, and I smiled back.
Smoke and Mirrors on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
Today at 2:15.
From Smoke and Mirrors to the weather. Today, rain in Northern Ireland, South Scotland and far Northern England. Sunny spells and variable cloud elsewhere.
And thence back to Smoke and Mirrors again, because coming up in the next half hour, former Labour Communications Chiefs Alistair Campbell and Tom Baldwin on Turmoil in Number 10, what happens when the spinner becomes the story.
You are listening to Today on Radio 4 with Justin Webb and Emma Barnett. It's 24 minutes to 8, and let's get a summary of the news from Caroline Nichols.
The UK economy has grown less than expected over the most recent quarter. New figures from the Office for National Statistics put growth at 0.1% between July and September. The figure for the previous quarter, April to June, was 0.3%. These are the final GDP figures before the budget later this month. The US Congress is set to vote next week on forcing the government to release files related to the investigation into the sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. A petition calling for the move reached a majority last night, hours after Democrats released 3 emails written by Epstein referencing Donald Trump. One suggests Mr. Trump spent hours with one of Epstein's victims. The White House says this was Virginia Giuffre, who never accused Mr. Trump of any wrongdoing. It says the Democrats are pushing a fake narrative. President Trump has signed a bill to end the 43-day shutdown of the US government after it was passed by the House of Representatives. Democrats had been refusing to reopen government unless Mr. Trump agreed to extend health insurance subsidies. But several broke ranks to vote with the Republican Party. It was the longest government shutdown in US history and saw hundreds of thousands of government workers going without pay. The Prime Minister has spoken to the Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, to smooth relations after suggestions were spread that Mr. Streeting might be eyeing a leadership challenge. Allies of Keir Starmer had briefed the press, indicating the Prime Minister would resist any attempt to oust him. Keir condemned the briefings, calling them unacceptable. Scientists say they've discovered why type 1 diabetes tends to be more aggressive in young children. Researchers at the University of Exeter found that the pancreas, which controls blood sugar levels, is still developing in early childhood, making it more vulnerable to immune system attacks. They say the findings could help develop treatments to slow progression of the disease.
Caroline, thank you. 22 minutes to 8. There are calls being reported in the Times newspaper for the sacking of the Prime Minister's most senior aide, his Chief of Staff, Morgan McSweeney, after a day of vicious press briefings against the Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, who was accused of plotting to remove Sir Keir Starmer from office should the budget in just under 2 weeks not go down so well. The BBC has also learned that the Prime Minister has apologised to Wes Streeting. But what does this all tell us, and what does it tell us about the Downing Street operation around the Prime Minister? Should it be of concern? Chris Mason is the BBC's political editor. Morning, Chris.
Morning.
What has been going on? I've summarised some of it there, but just to give us a deeper insight.
Well, I mean, there's been 24 hours of mudslinging. That's what's been going on, and that's what generates the kind of conversation this morning. And I think there's two key facts, Emma, at the heart of this that we shouldn't forget. The government is unpopular, and so is the Prime Minister. And those two facts are the rocket fuel behind absolutely everything else. And then to address directly what you were just talking about there around Morgan McSweeney, it's the old cliche, but it's a cliche because it's true. When advisers become the story, fairly or otherwise, it's bad news for a Prime Minister, and it can rapidly become bad news for the adviser. So, you know, I'm just off the phone from someone in government this morning. Keir needs to get his house in order, I was told. Well, who is the housekeeper, if you like, in a professional sense? It's Morgan McSweeney, the Chief of Staff. And there are folk in government saying, look, his head should be on a stick. Now, to be fair to him, I've approached him for comment. He isn't commenting. Wes Streeting has noticed that some of the briefing against him has carried on. So The Guardian is reporting that the Prime Minister is still angry with Mr. Streeting, frustrated, says the paper, at his remarks over welfare, digital ID and Gaza. And rather archly, those around Mr. Streeting are pointing out that this kind of briefing, as they see it, has followed Keir Starmer from opposition into government. Well, there are a declining number of folk who are around the Prime Minister in opposition who are still around him in government. And so you can see broadly where that kind of criticism seems to be pointed.
What does it tell us about paranoia in Downing Street?
It tells you a lot. It tells you that they are nervous. They are really nervous. And it goes back to those two central facts. They're really nervous because they know they as a government are unpopular. Those opinion poll ratings putting them in the teens. They know that the Prime Minister himself is unpopular, with some polling suggesting that he's the most unpopular Prime Minister since the invention of modern polling over the last generation or so. And when you have those fundamental realities that are there in black and white day to day, the root cause of almost everything else that you see and witness psychologically, if you like, in terms of how a government and how a Downing Street operation reacts to events, comes back to those central facts. And until or unless they're able to shift those central facts in the coming months, it's likely that variations on this saga will keep repeating themselves.
Chris Mason, thank you for that. Let's speak now to two men whose names we know impossibly, and especially if you're a keen follower of politics, but you weren't meant to know maybe at the time. Tom Baldwin, Ed Miliband's former communications director and author of a biography of Sir Keir Starmer, and Alistair Campbell, former director of communications for Tony Blair in Downing Street. Morning to you both.
Good morning.
Alistair, if I start with you, should Morgan McSweeney stay in post?
Well, in the end, that's up to the Prime Minister. But I do think that what we're seeing is in a media world that prefers scandal and personality to policy and trends, there are too many people inside politics who feed the frenzy rather than just get on with governing. And the worst thing about recent days, to my mind, is it's made a relatively new government with a massive majority look all too much like the last lot. Now, I became the story many, many times over. When I finally went, it was after asking, which was after almost a decade, it was after asking myself a few hard questions. Was I still enjoying it? Not as much as I was. Was it hurting my family? Definitely. Could anybody else come in and do the job? Probably. Above all, was there a possibility that I was doing harm as well as good? And I weighed all that up, and on balance, I decided it was time to go. Now, the point is, it was after almost a decade, as I say, when I was the story many times over. I think the difference, say, with Dominic Cummings and under Boris Johnson, or what seems to be happening now, is that though I might have made mistakes and gone a bit over the top at the time, I never, ever, ever lost sight of the fact that I was there to serve the Prime Minister and the government. I did not have my own agenda. I did not do my own thing. I made a lot of news, a lot of it probably unwelcome, but Tony Blair was always clear why that was happening. Now, Morgan is very, very important to Keir Starmer, has been for a long time. But they both hopefully know by now that governing and campaigning are not the same thing. Everybody in Number 10 should understand they are there to serve the Prime Minister and the government. Nobody should care what they think, what they do, what their great strategic thoughts are. And right now, the strategy isn't going very well.
Tom, let me bring you in. You know Keir Starmer, you know his inner circle. What's going on here?
I certainly think this sort of spin operation is the opposite of what Keir Starmer stands for, the kind of politics he likes. And he's always horrified by, you know, particularly attacks on colleagues and this sort of anonymous briefing. I think that in the short term, the damage of this story is that we're still talking about it, 36 hours after it broke. We're on the radio talking about spin and anonymous people in the sidelines and backroom advisors, rather than any of the things this government is doing to try to change the country.
And why do you think that's happening? That's what I'm trying to understand. What has he not done in his setup and in his structure around him? Because he may loathe this type of politics, but it's coming at this moment to define Downing Street right now.
Yeah, I mean, I think from the start of this government, there's been quite a lot of this backroom briefing. I mean, you had, you know, the first few weeks weren't actually about how they're changing the country, but it was about sort of their job titles, their salary levels, and how they all hated the previous chief of staff. You've had briefing against female cabinet ministers, cabinet ministers seen as out of favour for one reason or targets. And, you know, there are people who are employed to do communications. I don't believe that they were part of this operation. It does seem to have been done by more than one person in Downing Street to, you know, in an almost sort of freelance capacity. Now, I would think, you know, there's quite a lot of other things going on in government. There's a lot of important jobs to do. A lot of these people are very, very, very good at their jobs, but they should stick to their jobs rather than try and do everyone else's.
But I suppose what I'm driving at is, you know, I'll come back to Alistair in just a moment, but does he have control? You know, you can say this isn't his sort of politics, but if this is happening, why is it still happening?
Well, look, yeah, every organisation has people who leak out of it, including the BBC at times. But
yes, we know that.
The Prime Minister has made very clear he doesn't want anyone briefing against cabinet ministers. He doesn't like this anonymous briefing culture, and it has carried on. I think this is a wake up and smell the coffee moment where, you know, this is the time where he really can now get a grip on this and tell people.
And should he get rid of Morgan McSweeney then, as is being suggested by some to the Times?
I am sick of talking about this advisor or that advisor.
He's the chief.
No, but look, yeah, look, I think there's been far too much written about Morgan McSweeney or said about Morgan McSweeney. He's a hugely talented person who's achieved things I've never done in that, you know, he's won elections and, you know, he's very, very important to Keir Starmer and I expect he will stay. I think he should stick to doing the job he's been given, which is chief of staff. And Alistair talks about his time in Downing Street. I don't really remember talking to Jonathan Powell, who's the chief of staff when I was a journalist, more than once or twice that whole period. And I just think, you know, there's a lot of things to be done in government, a lot of things to be done in Downing Street. And briefing the papers, they've got people to do that, and they should let them go on and do it themselves.
Alistair, listening to what Tom's just had to say about, and you know, it does beg the question around whether he's in control or not, doesn't it?
Well, look, Tom makes a very, very important point there about Jonathan Powell. If I were working Downing Street now, I would just take a look at how Jonathan Powell does his job. He's in charge of, he's National Security Advisor, in charge of foreign policy. Jonathan could take massive credit for what happened in Ukraine, actually for what happened in Gaza as well in relation to the recent deal, because he just works away and does his job. He doesn't seek a profile. He doesn't like to tell people how great he is. He doesn't like us all to know what he's thinking of. And actually, Tom there fell into one of the traps that I think this whole debate does. He said Morgan McSweeney won an election. The Labour Party won an election led by Keir Starmer. And let me just say this. Everybody in public life, everybody, all of us, BBC, us, everybody, has a reputational bank and you have a goodwill bank and currency flows in and out. And a team that wins a landslide, that gets you a lot of currency in both banks. But something has gone dreadfully wrong that so much has drained in little over a year in government.
And what do you think
so
that
I
is?
Think this is a, because, well, partly because things are really, really tough. But look, both Tom and I have been saying for quite a long time, the government hasn't had a clear, for my mind, a clear, compelling strategy. It doesn't have a clear, compelling narrative about what it's trying to do. And they're making too many own goals. And the reason why this own goal is so damaging is because somebody has made a strategic decision, let's try and, you know, whack West Streeting, when there are bigger, worse enemies outside, like Nigel Farage, who, if we're not careful, are going to come in and take over this country and take it to a very dark place. So the message for all of them in Downing Street is get a grip and do the job you're meant to do.
It's whether you can get a grip with the same people. That is a fair question.
That is a fair question.
A lot of people will be asking that, listening to this, thinking, why was that taken? Why is that even viewed as strategic to try and whack someone on your own team? You know, comparisons to traitors have been made. Tom, final word to you on this. Do you think anything is actually going to change? And if so, what?
I don't think it's about sort of throwing bodies out of the building. This is, you know, people need to keep calm and carry on. This government has 161 working majority. It's a very long time until the next election. Keir Starmer is going absolutely nowhere out of Downing Street. He is, the tragedy of this story is, once again, we're not talking about changing the country. And I think this is the time to refocus.
But that's not journalists' fault, is it, on this occasion?
Well, I think there is. I think there's a cycle.
There is a cycle, but things have to happen. When you've got Wes Streeting on the radio saying himself he's being briefed against, journalists have to follow that.
Yeah, but look, journalists are addicted to this idea that the Prime Minister has to change every 1 year or 2 years, because that's what happened in the clown show of the Tory party. They're addicted to the drama and all this stuff. And there's a lot of people working inside politics who've grown up on that stuff and think that's how politics is conducted. Keir Starmer, I think, wants to represent a very different kind of politics. And I think people should take a lead from him rather than this advisor or that advisor or what they saw in the last Tory government, because that's not how politics should be. In fact, it's one of the reasons why people despise politics.
Tom Baldwin, Alistair Campbell, thank you.
10 to 8, time for Thought for the Day. The speaker this morning, Michael Hurley, who's Professor of Literature and Theology at the University of Cambridge.
Good morning. On Monday, Crisis, the UK's leading homelessness charity, published its State of the Nation report. It makes bleak reading. Last year, almost 300,000 people across England either found themselves sleeping rough or living in unsafe temporary accommodation. That's 45% higher than in 2012 and up 21% even since 2022. The solution to such a vast problem must be political as well as charitable. But the problem is also, it seems to me, psychological. As a nation, we seem to have accepted homelessness as an inevitable fact of modern life. Or perhaps we've just forgotten what being homeless really means. Consider some outdated synonyms. Vagrant, tramp, vagabond, drifter, itinerant, hobo, down and out, beggar, derelict, wayfarer, mendicant, squatter, rover. They're all striking in their own way, and there are other modern coinages too, like street person or rough sleeper. Yet homeless remains, I think, the best term we have. For a start, homeless doesn't carry the negative or criminal connotations that go along with, say, vagrant, tramp or derelict. Nor does it risk romanticising, like vagabond, wayfarer or drifter, which imply a free, chosen or even adventurous life. And the modern variations seem rather thinly descriptive. Homeless, by contrast, is a word with Old English roots that carries a deep meaning while also being boldly simple. It affirms a fundamental human need, the home, while signalling that this need remains unfulfilled. The word's meaning is almost self-explanatory, but it's been worn away by overuse so that we rarely reflect on what it actually spells out. From a Christian point of view, the home is not merely shelter, but a place of belonging and dignity. My people shall dwell in a peaceful habitation, says Isaiah. Catholic social teaching calls decent housing a basic human need, a matter of justice rather than charity, because to have a home is to share in the stability and security that God wills for every person made in his image. To be made homeless is therefore to be made in some sense less human. Research on people suffering homelessness in the UK documents, among other things, social isolation and stigma, depression, anxiety, and a loss of confidence. The moral measure of society is how far it allows such damage to go unanswered. Of course, merely talking about homelessness cannot itself solve the problem. That will cost money and requires practical changes of the kind laid out by the crisis report. Still, there is value in pausing over the language we use to remind ourselves why the problem matters in the first place. To recover what it really means to be homeless is no substitute for action, but it may just be where the will to act begins.
That was Thought for the Day with Michael Hurley. The time, 6 minutes to 8.
The front of the FT this morning contains terrible news for high-end cyclists, a significant tranche presumably of the Today audience. The tax benefits available to you through salary sacrifice are going to be blown up, the FT suggests. The government figure says tax breaks shouldn't go to high earners buying £4,000 e-bikes for weekend rides in the Surrey Hills. That, of course, just one of dozens of briefings, counter-briefings in the run-up to the budget. The more important one being a suggestion that employees' national insurance is going to be cut, income tax put up, breaking a manifesto pledge potentially. The context of the budget becoming clearer as well with the publication just an hour ago of the latest figures for growth in the economy. It rose by 0.1% in the third quarter, which is down from the second quarter, 0.3%, which it was itself down from 0.7% in quarter number one. So no good news there. Let us talk to Sir Howard Davis, former chair of the NatWest Bank and also director of the London School of Economics, and he's here in the studio. Morning to you.
Good morning.
And I suppose the first question, just following on from the discussion, that fascinating discussion we've just had about the politics of the moment, is whether that does have a material impact on the economy, because the suggestion from a lot of people is that it is.
Yeah, I think it's very hard to say exactly, and of course one always should preface any remarks about a quarterly figure with it could get revised up, it could get revised down, of course, too. But I would say that the way the government have been behaving in recent months is such that if they were trying to slow the economy down, I can't think of anything else I would do, because you demonstrate, first of all, that you've got trouble at the top of the government. You then conduct a series of remarkable leaks suggesting that you're going to tax property, you're going to tax wealth, you're going to tax gambling, you're going to tax banks, you're now going to tax even bikes, for goodness sake. And all of that is a sort of cumulative weighing down and creation of uncertainty. In addition, you have legislation which makes it more expensive to hire people, and you carry out a policy of public spending whereby public sector wages are going up by 6.6% a year and private sector by 4.2%, and that is stopping the Bank of England from reducing interest rates, which would help as well. So there's a whole series of things which are not appropriate.
Not appropriate, but I mean, we keep being told the rhetoric is about growth, isn't it? Been about growth since they came in. But what you're suggesting is that the plan that would bring that growth is utterly absent still.
I would say so. I mean, there are some individual things. There is public sector investment in the programme, which I think is positive. There's an announcement of nuclear power reactors beginning to be rebuilt. And there's things like that, the Heathrow runway, etc. But they're all jam tomorrow at the moment. And what's going on this year is not a series of policies conducive to stimulate growth. It's a series of policies to create uncertainty, as far as I can see, which is not good for investment and not good for growth.
And that's the point, isn't it? That if you run fiscal policy in order to fill a hole there or fill a hole there, solve a problem here, solve a problem there, find some money here, find some money there. That is a completely separate thing, you are saying, from having an actual plan that says this is where we want to get to and this is how we get there.
Yes, well, and the charitable view would be that they are trying to transition from an impossible place to a slightly more possible place.
Yeah, that's certainly what they tell us when they come on.
The impossible place was where they came in and saying that we're not going to increase national insurance, they're not going to increase VAT, they're not going to increase income tax. And that was an impossible place to be, given the structural deficits in the economy. So they're now transitioning to a place where maybe they have a coherent approach to fiscal policy, which may allow them to do some other things within it.
Just final thought. If they were to go, if Keir Starmer and Rachel Reeves were to go, or just Rachel Reeves, would that, do you think, have such an impact on the bond markets, which is what we are told behind the scenes, that actually would throw our economy into further disarray or not?
I think it would depend on from which wing of the party the new chancellor came. Because Rachel Reeves is perceived in the markets as being someone who does understand both sides of a balance sheet and who is conscious, if you like, of the risks of allowing borrowing to let rip. And if they had somebody from the a wing of the party who suggested that he didn't care about the bond markets, for example, then that would cause a lot of concern.
So, Howard Davis, thank you.
Let's get the latest on the weather. Simon King's back. Hi again, Simon.
Hello, Emma. Good morning. Yeah, across England and Wales, for most of us, it's a dry start. There'll be some sunshine out there this morning as well. Still just a little bit of rain affecting the far north of England. And there'll be a bit of rain that continuing into the afternoon, the cloud increasing a little bit as well. And it's across southern England where we'll also see the cloud increasing with some rain arriving during the afternoon, certainly turning quite wet by this evening. And maximum temperatures across England and Wales about 13 to 16 degrees. But it's for Northern Ireland, Central and Southern Scotland, where it's very wet at the minute, and this rain is going to continue all day today. It may just peter out a little bit during the afternoon, but certainly very soggy conditions, could be some localised flooding. For the far north of Scotland, staying largely dry, some sunny spells, one or two showers, and top temperatures about 6 to 9 Celsius.
Simon, thank you. You are listening to Today on Radio 4 with Emma Barnett and Justin Webb.
It's 8 o'clock on Thursday, the 13th of November. Good morning. Good morning if you're just joining us. The headlines. Economic growth has slowed to 0.1% in the 3 months to September, in a setback for the Chancellor ahead of the budget. BBC News has been told that the Prime Minister has apologised to the Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, for Downing Street briefings against him. The UK's first small nuclear reactors are to be built in Anglesey in North Wales.
Also,
when the Hunger Games takes this stage, I will be watching. Will you?
As a stage version of the Hunger Games opens in a bespoke super theatre in Canary Wharf, is this the beginning of the end for London's West End and...
We might be Delulu, but we're trying to save our pub from being knocked down, along with its rich 400-year history.
Our pub has so much riz, and here's why.
Spill the tea!
Can social media save a village pub by sending its regulars viral? The BBC News is read this morning by Caroline Nichols.
Official figures show the UK economy saw weaker than expected growth of 0.1% between July and September. That's down from 0.3% in the previous quarter. These are the final figures on economic output ahead of the Chancellor's budget in 2 weeks' time. Here's our Deputy Economics Editor, Darshini David.
Growth is the government's number one mission, but these numbers are a reminder that there's a way to go before it can say mission accomplished, allow for population growth, and there was no improvement in output per person over the summer. The shutdown at Jaguar Land Rover hit activity in September. Production in the car sector fell 29% that month. But even excluding that, momentum has been lost since the start of the year. Growth slowed in key sectors such as services and construction, and those are the areas most likely to have seen costs increase as a result of last year's budget policies. Consumer spending growth remains weak. Surveys suggest some have been more hesitant to spend due to concerns about this budget's contents. The Chancellor admits there's more to be done. The challenge for her is to boost confidence and activity at the budget, even while announcing tax rises that will take billions out of pockets and the economy.
The US Congress is set to vote next week on forcing the Department of Justice and the FBI to release files from the investigation into the sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. A petition calling for the move reached a majority in the House of Representatives last night, hours after Democrats released emails written by Epstein referencing Donald Trump. They've acknowledged the messages contain no evidence of wrongdoing. Republicans responded to what they called cherry-picking by releasing more than 23,000 pages of documents, also from Epstein's estate. The White House has accused Democrats of trying to smear the president. Here's our North America editor, Sarah Smith.
The vote in the House of Representatives could trigger the largest Republican rebellion against Donald Trump since he returned to the White House. Already, some of his most loyal supporters have broken with the president on this issue. If the bill passes in the House, it is likely to fail in the Senate and would anyway need to be signed by Donald Trump before it could become law. The president is named in some of the emails that were released yesterday. In one of them, Jeffrey Epstein apparently told his accomplice Ghislaine Maxwell that Donald Trump spent hours at his house with one of Epstein's victims. The woman's name is redacted, but the White House says it is Virginia Giuffre and points to previous comments she has made saying she never saw Mr. Trump doing anything wrong. In another 2019 email, Epstein said, "Mr. Trump came to my house many times and never got a massage." Yet the continuing release of information linking Donald Trump to the late sex offender further increases the political pressure on him to publish all the information the government holds on Jeffrey Epstein.
The emails also appear to show Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor pleading with Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell to make clear that he was not involved in the allegations against them. In one, the former prince writes, "This has nothing to do with me. I can't take any more of this." Mr. Mountbatten-Windsor, who was stripped of his royal titles last month, has always denied any wrongdoing. The longest ever shutdown of the US federal government has ended after President Trump signed into law a bill to restore its funding. The legislation was passed in the House of Representatives last night, with Republicans and Democrats voting largely along party lines. The closure lasted 43 days. Hundreds of thousands of workers went without pay, including air traffic controllers, causing major disruption to flights. Sir Keir Starmer has spoken to the Health Secretary Wes Streeting to smooth relations after suggestions were spread by those close to the Prime Minister that Mr. Streeting might be eyeing a leadership challenge. Downing Street figures briefed journalists at the BBC and elsewhere, leading Mr. Streeting to claim there was a toxic culture at Number 10. Here's our political correspondent, Damian Grammaticus.
Yesterday, Wes Streeting branded as juvenile and self-defeating nonsense the claim spread by some in Downing Street that he might be considering ousting the Prime Minister. It led to 24 hours of turmoil for the government. And last night, to patch things up, Sir Keir Starmer spoke with his health secretary by telephone. In the brief call, the BBC has been told Sir Keir apologised to Mr. Streeting. It's understood the Prime Minister was incandescent about the storm ignited by the anonymous briefings. The Labour Party chair, Anna Turley, said there would be an investigation into who had been responsible and action would be taken. The aim of those who'd stoked the suggestion the Prime Minister might be facing a challenge from within was, it seems, to convey that this would be a dangerous course for the party and be met with defiance from Sir Keir. But it left Downing Street having to douse the fires set from within and has shone a light on the deep unease within Labour at the dire poll ratings both the party and its leader face.
A senior MP has called for an investigation after BBC News revealed that two hospitals had continued to use a heart device despite knowing of concerns that it had a higher mortality rate than a rival product. Leading clinicians at both hospitals, the Freeman in Newcastle and Harefield in London, were paid consultants for the manufacturer of the mechanical pump. More details from our correspondent, Michael Buchanan.
The hospitals continued to use the mechanical heart pump after an NHS audit had shown its mortality rate over a nearly two-year period was three times higher than a rival product. A subsequent analysis of those who'd received the device after the concerns had been raised showed that patients died at a higher rate than for the other pump. The two men who led the transplant centres at the Freeman and Harefield hospitals had also been paid consultants for the device's manufacturer for a decade. Leila Moran, who chairs the Health Select Committee, said she was deeply concerned and urged the General Medical Council to investigate. Both hospitals say they were aware the cardiologists had a role with the pump's makers, that this was common practice and that they believed at the time there had been no clear clinical grounds to stop using the device. They say they also had questioned the NHS data. The pump was later withdrawn on safety grounds by the manufacturer.
Anglesey in North Wales has been chosen as the location for the UK's first small nuclear reactors, which the government says will help power the equivalent of around 3 million homes by the middle of the next decade. Three modular reactors will be housed at Wilver, the site of an old decommissioned nuclear power station. Some wanted a larger, traditional nuclear plant, but Simon Bowen, who chairs the publicly owned Great British Energy Nuclear, told this programme there was a need for both types.
For now, we believe that the right solution for the nuclear programme is to put small modular reactors at Wilver. And it's a milestone decision for us moving forward, and we're delighted that we've got what is the best characterised site in the UK. That doesn't, however, mean that we're not going to look at future gigawatt reactors, because they all fit in the mix.
New research shows that the world's use of coal, oil and gas this year will release more carbon dioxide than ever before. The study shows that emissions from fossil fuels will rise by just over 1%. But it also shows the growth of carbon output has slowed over the past decade as renewable energy has taken off. Analysis of Adolf Hitler's DNA for a Channel 4 documentary suggests that he had a genetic disorder that hinders sexual development. The sample was obtained from material taken from the couch where Hitler shot himself in 1945. The geneticist, Professor Turi King, who worked on the programme, told us the findings suggested there could be some truth to the wartime rumours about Hitler having underdeveloped genitals.
I have some wonderful colleagues at the Pasteur Institute who found that he has a deletion in a gene which we know is strongly associated with a condition known as Kallmann syndrome, which is characterized by low testosterone levels, by abnormal development of the sexual organs, and in 5 to 10% of cases, a micropenis.
A new exhibition at an art gallery in central London features 10 tonnes of old rope with a price tag of £1 million. It's the work of the Turner Prize-nominated artist David Shrigley, who's been showing it to our correspondent Colin Patterson.
Four enormous piles of rope that are taller than me, and I'm 6'5".
David Shrigley's artwork is heavier than a T-Rex or 2.5 hippos.
The starting point was money for old rope. I guess I was interested in the idea that this is a thing that has no value. The most important thing was to make sure it didn't stink of dead sea creatures. So we achieved that.
He is confident a buyer will be found to pay the £1 million price tag for the rope, which in total is 20 miles long, meaning it could stretch from the Mayfair Gallery to St Albans.
Colin Patterson reporting.
It's 10 minutes past eight. Thanks very much, Caroline. When you think of the most pressing issues on people's minds living in the UK today, you could be forgiven for imagining it might be the economy, their finances, job opportunities, education, access to decent health services and housing. We also know there are concerns about immigration and climate change, and that they're top of mind for some people too. These all vary depending on what polling you look at. But what about the top concerns for teenagers? It might surprise you. Earlier this week, we spoke to Peter Hyman, a former Labour Party adviser who's co-authored a report for the think tank Demos called Inside the Mind of a 16-year-old.
What was striking going around the country properly listening is young people don't think they're listened to at all. So to give you one example, the issue that came up everywhere we went was knife crime. And yet they don't think politicians are really gripping that in a way that they think they would if it was for a different age group.
Someone who will sadly perhaps not be surprised by that and the prevalence of knife crime as a concern in young people's minds is our next guest, Caroline Wilgoose, whose 15-year-old son, Harvey, was stabbed to death at his school in Sheffield in February of this year by a fellow 15-year-old who had been his friend. That former friend, Mohammed Umar Khan, was carrying a hunting knife and was sentenced last month to life with a minimum of 16 years detention for murdering Harvey. They'd rowed over something on social media in the days before the deadly attack. Despite an overall decrease in knife incidents in the UK in 2024, more than a third of police forces have recorded increases in the knife offence level in schools. Caroline is now campaigning to make schools safer from knives and specifically wants emergency bleed kits to be in all schools. A person can die within 3 to 5 minutes if they're suffering from a catastrophic bleed. It takes 7 minutes to respond to a Category 1 emergency. Bleed kits, then, can be a lifesaver, and Harvey's school did not have one. Caroline Wilgoose joins me now. Good morning.
Good morning.
May I start by saying how sorry I am, how sorry we all are for you and your family's loss.
Thank you.
And thank you for being with us today. I thought before we spoke about Harvey and what happened, we could hear a bit more about your plan to be part of a team donating and installing emergency bleed kits, I believe, in 15 schools in Sheffield next week.
We're going to start with 15 schools that's come forward. Every school in Sheffield's come forward to accept a bleed kit. So we're doing it in two stages. So we're doing 15 starting from Hindhouse School at 10 o'clock on Monday, and then delivering, going into two teams and delivering seven each so it'd be 15 altogether. And then next month, hopefully another 15 and so on, and try and go to Rotherham and try and get them in as many schools as we can. Because we've got to start somewhere, teaming up with CJ Bennett and Kyle Hodgkins that are coming up from London. They're very anti-knife crime people. So we've all jumped on board.
We're just going to see if we can slightly improve your line, hopefully, while I'm talking to you, because it's a little bit glitchy and we really want to hear what you have to say. But there'll be a lot of people, myself included, who haven't heard of these emergency bleed kits. And in terms of, I hear that you're going to be providing training for schools, but, you know, a lot of people will be very shocked to hear that this is even needed.
Yes, I know. And in Sheffield, there's only two places that are registered to provide a bleed kit, which isn't the case. I think what people are getting these, but you have to register it. So people, when they ring 999, they can tell you where the nearest bleed kit is. But it's got to be registered.
And these kits help stem the loss of blood.
Yeah, within seconds.
Okay. And for you, I mean, do you believe that your son's life would have been saved if this had been in the school?
I'm not sure. Well, I will never be sure, will I? But if there would have been one in place, then I would have known whether it could have saved him or not.
Yes.
You can't take risks.
And I suppose just hearing there that the level of concern that knife crime, that teenagers have about knife crime, it's extraordinary to hear it like that, isn't it?
Yeah, but children are carrying knives for their own safety, but you're putting yourself more in danger carrying a knife, which is another thing that we're doing. We're going into the schools and talking to the children about the pure devastation of knife crime, and there's no winners. The lad that's done this to Harvey, he's lost his life as well. We've got to start going in young.
Let's come on to him in just a moment. But was knife crime and knives something that your son was concerned about, that Harvey was worried about?
I didn't think so until the lockdown the week before, when he said that children had knives in schools. And now we're like, as if children are going to take knives into schools. But since then, children have come forward to me and said they know that there's knives in schools. It were on Education Yorkshire the other day that there was a knife in school. And this is why I'm still campaigning about knife arches in every school.
Knife arches meaning when people walk into school, some kind of security...
Metal detector. Yeah. I mean, I've gone into schools since Harvey because I've been campaigning, but they need to go in every single school as soon as possible. We've got to start somewhere.
You think it's that bad that we need metal detectors in all schools?
Yeah. We know. I mean, schools are going in lockdown weekly now through knives being in schools, or rumoured that there's knives in schools.
You mentioned a lockdown at his school just earlier, before this happened.
Yeah, there was on the Wednesday the week before the school went into lockdown. Harvey was a school avoider, so he wasn't in school. And I said to him, your school's been locked down. And he said, yeah, because someone's got a weapon in there for me. He said, for him. And I said, oh, give over, Harvey. And he sent his dad a text that day saying, this is why I don't go to school, because children carry knives, Dad. And we didn't believe him. We thought, it's so far-fetched. You think you relate it to gang culture. Well, Harvey weren't in a gang. And children... It's taking knives to protect themselves, and you're putting yourself more in danger carrying knives.
You say Harvey was a school avoider. Was you say also because of fear around knives? Was that the only reason, or was he suffering from some kind of anxiety?
He had anxiety. He was a COVID child. Like, we've got many of them that are Harvey's age that are school avoiders because they were locked up for 2 years of their life, and he went from a primary school into a big school, and, you know, it was like business as usual, and then we wonder why they've got, these kids have got all different needs, and anxiety, which Harvey was terrible with his anxiety attacks and stuff. And we just thought, you just have it drilled into you that your children have got to go to school, and he was just saying, and he did used to get annoyed with us, and we did used to have arguments in the morning. There's holes in his walls through being frustrated because we didn't understand. And I do understand that now. I understand why children... It didn't even happen in the war that children got locked up. They got locked up, they couldn't go to the park, they couldn't see the grandparents. Some children lost their grandparents in that time. And they got plonked into this great big school, and it's like business as usual. Well, there's no wonder that they're suffering with anxiety, because they were locked up for 2+ years.
And then I suppose adding into that, we have talked a lot anecdotally about what was the result and the impact on children who went through that. But hearing this from you, on top of that, he had a fear of knives in school. What was Harvey like as a boy?
He was funny, popular, cheeky, like the teachers that were witnesses, they said... He used to check on them, they used to check on him. He went in and showed his brand new coat, what his nan had bought that morning, telling him that his nan and granddad had gone away. And he was just a lovely kid and could talk to any age, because we were, you know, he got 2 older siblings, so our house were always busy. He always had his friends at our house, and that's another thing that I'm doing. I'm trying to get a youth club set up for somewhere for children to go and learn to socialise again.
Because I think also what's very striking, Caroline, is you've said you want to meet the boy who did this.
I haven't said that I want to meet.
Is that not right?
No.
Tell me more.
I got asked if I would consider it further down the line, and I said at the moment.
Caroline, I'm so sorry. The line has glitched slightly there.
Things might change.
Okay, so not at the moment, but things might change.
No.
Thank you very much for...
I don't think he's been let... I think both of the boys have been let down. Because there were so many red flags that this kid had problems and an interest with weapons and stuff. And his mum reported to the school in December that there were an axe, he'd be taking an axe into school. And it should have been looked at what's on his phone at that time. That's a red flag for the police,
yes,
for the school.
Caroline, we'll have to leave it there. Again, sorry for some of the glitches there on the line for you and for our listeners, but Caroline Will Goose, good luck with the campaign to get those emergency bleed kits into schools, starting with those schools in Sheffield next week, where her son was at school, 15-year-old son Harvey, who was stabbed to death at his school in Sheffield of February of this year.
21 minutes past eight. The future of nuclear power is being launched today in Anglesey. 3 small modular reactors are going to be built at Wilver. They'll come online, we are told, in the mid-2030s. The American ambassador, very unusually, has publicly attacked the decision, saying a big nuclear plant would be better. He wanted the American company Westinghouse involved. He also criticised the UK's continuing high energy costs. All of this, of course, coming as the government tries to project power and purpose against a backdrop of what seems to many like bizarre self-harm. Let us talk about all of this to Ed Miliband, the Secretary of State for Energy and Climate Change, who is on the line from Anglesey. Now, morning to you.
Good morning, Justin.
Let's start with what is going wrong in number 10. We talked to Wes Streeting yesterday, and he talked about juvenile self-defeating nonsense coming from number 10. Why? What's happening in there, do you think?
Look, I think you get briefings that happen in politics. They're an unfortunate part of politics. I deplore the culture of briefing. I think there's a very clear lesson, though, for everyone in our party, which is we need to focus on the country, not on ourselves. And what, and look, these periods of turbulence happen in government, Justin. I was there during the Blair Brown years. What powers you through is a focus on your mission, how you want to change this country. That is what I am focused on. I know that's what Keir is going to want us focused on. And that's where all of the Labour Party and all of the government
but
needs to be focused.
It seems so peculiar to people when they hear that from you and when they've heard it in the past from Keir Starmer himself. And when you came into government saying all these things, that you haven't been able to manage it, that you've still got this breaking out in Number 10. And it is, of course, a very serious thing, isn't it, when you have Number 10 people briefing against other cabinet ministers. It's what is it that stops it? Alistair Campbell was suggesting to us half an hour or so ago that actually you've got to have people who are just willing to get down, do their jobs and not take any favours from anyone and not be in the limelight themselves. Is that part of it?
Look, I'm not going to speculate on this. Look, it's bad. It's bad when it happens. It's been a bad couple of days. But as I say, you know, Alistair was there during the Blair Brown years, and that was no tea party when it came to the whole briefing issue. You know, it was also quite had its unstable moments. So and I think, you know, what made that government a success was its sense of purpose and its sense of mission. And, you know, I feel like what happened last year was we were given a historic opportunity to change this country as people have long wanted it changed. In particular, so many people feel this country doesn't work for them, and we've got a responsibility. And you know, my 100% focus and the whole of the government's 100% focus has got to be on that. We've got to learn the lesson of this episode to say, right, this is not where the focus can be. This is self-defeating, as you said, self-inflicted wounds, and we've got to face to the country.
How confident are you that's going to happen?
I am confident it's going to happen because I think it's what Keir wants. And I've talked in the past to him about these issues of the briefings, and I know he absolutely deplores it. He hates it. He hates it when things get leaked. He hates it when cabinet colleagues get briefed against. The truth is, people listening to this programme might think, well, if he hates it so much, why can't he stop it? Well, because the problem is that sometimes these things do happen and there are noises off and you can never quite know where they're coming from.
Ah,
you know, that's the truth.
Yeah, so if he did know where they're coming from, you think he should get rid of the person involved?
Of course.
Right.
Of course he should.
And if he were to stand down, would you stand to be leader?
No.
To be Prime Minister?
No. I've had the... I support Keir, but I've had the, if you like, the inoculation technique against wanting to be leader of the Labour Party, because I was leader of the Labour Party, and that was a very successful inoculation.
Okay, to wider things, but first, I suppose, something that isn't necessarily that much wider. So we've had the growth figures this morning. They're pretty disappointing. They're not going in the right direction. And one of the things Howard Davis, which has been talking to Sir Howard Davis on the programme, the former chair of the NatWest and director of the LSE, etc., 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 one of the things he was suggesting is that the political instability, and not just briefings, but also all the fuss in the run-up to the budget, is this going to happen, is that going to happen, etc., etc., that this has a material impact on the economy, and that for that, this government is itself wholly responsible.
Look, I think, I respect Howard, but the truth is that there's global turbulence going on, not least the tariffs from the US, which has had a real effect across the world. We had the cyber attack on JLR, which had something to do with today's growth figures. But, you know, I think I've said to you in the earlier part of this interview, what's happened has been bad. And you know, government showing where its mission is and what it's really focused on is important. If you take clean energy, for example, the net zero economy grew three times faster than the economy as a whole last year. It's partly because we've got a sense of mission, because we've got clarity about what we're doing, that people want to come and invest in this country. I think I'm right in saying the largest single area of investment we've seen since this government was elected is in clean energy, because business has confidence that we know where we're going, we know the direction of travel, and
but that's interesting,
in
yeah, because even those who disagree with you, and there are plenty of them, even those who disagree with you would say you know what you're doing, you know what you're trying to achieve in your department. You're very open about it, even if you haven't got there yet, particularly when it comes to lower prices, etc. But what they're saying is the rest of the government, and particularly Rachel Reeves, doesn't seem to have the same sense of what it is, what the story is, in a sense, the narrative. You have a narrative in your department. People say that there is no narrative about what the government is trying to achieve more widely.
Well, I don't think that's fair about the Chancellor, Rachel, because I think she has a very clear priority, which is to grow our economy so that it can she can raise the living standards of people in this country.
But she keeps doing things that lead to less growth.
I'm not sure. I don't know what the evidence is for
Hang on. Let me give you a bit of the evidence. Yeah. So two things. Number one, the decision last budget time, to put extra taxes on businesses. So the added national insurance tax, the employer's national insurance tax. Also, all the things that are coming down the track when it comes to improved workers' rights that they say, the businesses say, make it less likely to invest. So what businesses tell us is that all the things that you say Rachel Reeves wants, she is not putting in place stuff that achieves that.
Well, let me take both of those just briefly. Look, first of all, the reason we took the decisions we did on tax was because we wanted to invest in the future of we wanted to invest in our public services, but also fiscal stability is the absolute bedrock of economic growth. And I think Rachel is right to emphasize that. On the second point, look, we have a different view about what makes a successful economy from some of those businesses. The truth is Britain has two long-standing economic problems: productivity and inequality, and both of them are related. But because we are so unequal, we are less productive as a country. So actually, I don't agree with those people who say that if you have more workers' rights, it makes your economy less successful. In fact, there are lots of European countries, including some of the Scandinavians, who are very successful with significant workers' rights. We can do both of those things, and that is part of our vision of what a successful economy looks like.
Thought about nuclear, because it is important what you're announcing today, isn't it? Very important. The American ambassador seems annoyed with it. What? Tell us, take us behind the scenes as much as you can. What's going on there? He says you should have one bigger nuclear reactor that would have taken longer to build, but actually would have been better for us in the longer run.
I think the clue was in your description of what he said. He wanted an American company to be on this site. Look, we've chosen, let me just give the context, we've chosen the prime site, which is Wylfa here in North Wales, for our flagship program of small modular reactors. Rolls-Royce, a British company, not an American company, sadly for the American ambassador, which is going to build a fleet of up to 8 small modular reactors. Why is this exciting? Why is this part of the future? Thousands of jobs, clean power for 3 million homes, but also small and modular, built off-site, mostly built off-site, which can help bring the cost down. And you can replicate them. Part of the challenge of large-scale nuclear is there aren't that many of them, and so you can't bring the cost down as you can with wind and solar and all of that. So this is really exciting. We're in the lead in Europe. Rolls-Royce is in the lead in Europe. They won this competition that we had fair and square, and that's what we're doing today. And it is part of this bigger thing we've been talking about in this interview, which is how do we change? So many people in this country, Justin, feel the country doesn't work for me. My living standards are stuck. I can't find a good job for my son or daughter. And we are about changing that. And this is absolutely bang on part of
it. Ed Miliband, Secretary of State for Energy and Climate Change, talking to us from Anglesey. Thank you.
8:30. Mike's back with the latest on the sport. Hi, Mike.
Hello again, Emma. Ben Stokes has taken 4 wickets for England on day one of their one and only Ashes warm-up match. This game is currently ongoing out in Perth. England Lions are 309/5. You can follow that on the BBC Sport website. We now, though, are going to talk boxing, because their meeting in April delivered what was, for many people, one of the best British fights of recent times. And this weekend, they're doing it all again.
Well, back in the 1990s, their famous fighting forebears brought Britain to a standstill. Now, the sons of the fathers reanimate British boxing's most famous rivalry as Chris Eubank Jr. and Conor Benn collide in a clash for familial bragging rights. The latest challenge.
Yes, Conor Benn and Chris Eubank Jr., the sons of British boxing greats Nigel Benn and Chris Eubank Sr., respectively, met back in April, with Eubank Jr. winning on points. This Saturday, the much-anticipated rematch takes place at the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium once again. Eddie Hearn is promoting the fight, and he's with us live in the studio this morning. Hi, Eddie.
Good morning, good morning.
We had to wait 3 years, didn't we, to get a rematch between Nigel Benn and Eubank Sr. back in 1993. You've managed to arrange this in 7 months.
Yeah, a little bit easier with the sons. And really, there should have been a third between the fathers, because the second fight was a controversial draw. But we never got there. Now we've got the rematch quite quickly of what was a classic first time around. I think there was, you know, the feel of, is it going to replicate the father's quality of battle? And it really did. And I think it will do so again on Saturday.
And important to say, Connor is your fighter. You are firmly in the Ben corner. He lost last time. What will he do differently this time around?
I think the experience, you know, he's the much younger man. He's coming up two weight classes to take the fight. He's grown into that weight class. I think the last time would have taken a lot out of both men. And I think Conor fought off emotion last time, just like his father, really. But I think this time, a little bit smarter in his approach. Still be a real war in there, but I expect him to be a little bit more experienced this time and the fresher guy.
Whereas Eubank Jr. is 7 years older than Conor Benn. And am I right in thinking that you think he will retire after this match, regardless of the result?
I think there's a lot, you know, last time, like I said, took a lot out of both guys. I think there was a feeling between the family and the team that we don't really want to see you have too many more fights like that. Eubank Jr. is a very tough man, very stubborn, you know, and he will not, you know, he will not give in there. But I just think sometimes when the team around go, you know, how many more are you going to have like that? When you go back into the trenches, you know, how many more times can you go? And I think Connor's just done that once and he's ready for more.
And Eubank Sr. arriving unannounced at the stadium in April was arguably the moment of the entire evening in North London. He's definitely going to be there this week.
He will be. He will be. Yeah, he's some character. Some character.
Weather not looking great Saturday. Are you worried about that?
Don't worry about that. I mean, you know, I think we've got 10,000 ponchos coming in. They're a tenner each. I'm only joking. They're not. They won't be. Don't worry. Don't worry. They won't. It was a joke. Yeah. But listen, for some reason, apparently the rain is going to leave us alone on Saturday night. But that outdoor experience, there'll be 70,000 people at Tottenham Hotspur. It'll be an incredible event.
It will be. I just want to briefly ask you about another fighter you are heavily associated with, Anthony Joshua. Reports this morning that he's agreed to fight the YouTuber Jake Paul next month in Miami. Really?
A couple of things. I mean, definitely not agreed yet. And you know, the fact of the YouTuber, I think, is a little bit harsh on what Jake has done. We are planning a potential small run out this year against someone you've probably never heard of. If it is Jake Paul, and he will be compensated considerably to do that, we may take the opportunity to end Jake Paul's run in our great sport. But a lot of work to do, yeah, I'm not sure. The focus is Tyson Fury. The focus is the World Heavyweight Championship. But never say never.
Yeah, but come on, Eddie. Joshua is a two-time former heavyweight champion of the world. What's he doing fighting blokes off social media? Like, I know why he's doing it. You've alluded to it. He's got sackfuls of money in it for him. But isn't he damaging his reputation there?
Not really. I mean, he's done everything he can in the sport. The plan was to go out and have an undercard fight this year, just to... He's been out of the ring for nearly a year and a half. If he receives several tens of millions to do that and we get a chance to silence this guy that's annoyed the boxing community for a long time, maybe. A lot of work to do. But the focus for us really is 2026. And that is a big fight in February or March. And then Tyson Fury. We want the real stuff. But we look at the business as well.
Is that Fury Joshua fight, which would be arguably the biggest fight in British boxing history, is that still a realistic aim?
Yes, it is. And Turki Alashaykh, who's here this week, he wants to make the biggest fights in the sport. He'll negotiate with us individually. We're on board for that fight. We've already made our intentions clear to him. He will talk to Team Tyson Fury. So I prefer he does that rather than me. I think he might do better at it than me. But I truly believe Fury Joshua will happen in 2026. So that's the main focus for us.
If and when it does, you'll come back on the programme to talk to us about it. Well, yeah. We look forward to that and enjoy this weekend. The rematch, much anticipated, between Nigel Benn and Chris... Sorry, not Nigel Benn.
Nigel looks well. He's 61. Yeah, he could have seen him.
No, that was 30 years ago. Conor Benn and Chris Eubank Jr. In the names of the fathers, doing it again this Saturday. And I should say, you can listen to the fight on 5 Live. Full coverage from 7 p.m. on BBC Sounds. Switching to 5 Live, 10 p.m. You won't miss a moment.
No poncho needed for 5 Live.
No, definitely not.
Mike, thank you. We can enjoy drama inspired by an iconic story this weekend.
Don't you go getting yourself into trouble.
What's where you're going, you little weasel?
Sorry, Mr. Badger, sir. Trouble is easy when it's expected of you.
The Wind in the Willows, reimagined from the margins.
I want to find my parents. I want to go home.
Narrated by Penelope Wilton.
The rumble of the diggers and the dozers and the chainsaws had become a familiar one in the wildwood of late.
The Wind in the Willows, a weasel's tale.
Love is shown in doing everything one can.
On Radio 4 and BBC Sounds. This Sunday at 3.
And while your mind might be on nature, let me tell you the latest of the weather today. Rain in Northern Ireland, South Scotland and far northern England. Sunny spells and variable cloud apparently available elsewhere.
You are listening to Today on Radio 4 with Emma Barnett and Justin Webb. It is 23 minutes to 9. Caroline Nichols has the news.
New figures from the Office for National Statistics show the UK economy grew less than expected over the most recent quarter. Economic growth stood at 0.1% between July and September, down from 0.3% in the previous quarter. The US Congress is set to vote next week on forcing the government to release files related to the investigation into the sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. A petition calling for the move reached a majority last night, hours after Democrats released three emails written by Epstein referencing Donald Trump, who says he's being smeared by his opponents. BBC News has been told that Sir Keir Starmer has apologised to the Health Secretary Wes Streeting after suggestions were spread that Mr Streeting might be eyeing a leadership challenge. Allies of the Prime Minister had briefed the press indicating he would resist any attempt to oust him. Sir Keir has said the briefings were unacceptable. Anglesey in North Wales has been chosen as the location for the UK's first small-scale nuclear reactors. The government says construction of the site at Wilver will support up to 3,000 jobs in the local community.
Thank you. 22 minutes to 9 is the time. We have talked recently about efforts to bring the Gaza conflict to a longer-term end. There are now, it seems, some steps in train, as it were. The UN Security Council is going to meet to start negotiations, or at least behind the scenes to start negotiations, on a US-drafted resolution, which would then endorse the Donald Trump Gaza peace plan and authorise a mandate as well for some kind of transitional body. Let's talk to Jeremy Byrne, our international editor, who is on the lines. A long way to go, Jeremy. When the Security Council begin to talk about it, it enables us, doesn't it, to begin to think about what some sort of transitional government, security system, etc., might look like. Do you have a sense of what it is that they're going to try to achieve?
I've got a sense of where the negotiations are going at the moment, Justin. Certainly what they're trying to achieve is to put into action the Trump 20-point peace plan, which had these objectives without actually saying how they were going to get there. And one of the most significant in that is clearly the disarmament of Hamas. Now, what's happened is that the United States has submitted a draft resolution, which, as always happens at the UN in New York, is being discussed. The British and the French and others are sending in potential edits into this. Now, the information I have from diplomatic sources is that the Americans are resistant to many changes in the wording of all of this. And there are various leaked versions which are going around. And it uses, and you can see the deficiencies in it from a point of view of really any other side other than perhaps the Israelis and the Americans, which is that it doesn't really mention the Palestinians. It doesn't really link much with the West Bank. In other words, ideas of a Palestinian state. And I think possibly most concerningly, it uses very robust language about the activities of the as yet to be formed International Stabilization Force, an international force which is meant to bring stability to the area, and the hope or plan or suggestion is that the troops would be provided by Arab and Muslim countries. But the language of the resolution is suggesting that it might even have to use force to try to disarm Hamas. Now, you will not find Arab or Muslim countries prepared to contribute to a force that will be seen as a subcontractor for the IDF, because apart from anything else, governments won't want to do it. They wouldn't want to send their troops into harm's way, and it would go down really, really badly at home. So right now, there are real issues, according to Western diplomatic sources, with the language that the Americans want to use.
So what's the way out of that, potentially? I mean, leave Hamas armed and still there, or I mean, they have to send a force eventually, don't they? What directions are being explored, do you think?
Well, I think the way out of it is to try to find different kinds of language that could be used, that the Americans perhaps could be more flexible in terms of the kind of suggestions which I think the British and the French have got in mind, in terms of trying to make it more of a holistic proposition, because at the moment it's mostly about this Board of Peace. A lot of it is about this so-called Board of Peace, which is the governing body which has been which Trump has envisaged, which has been condemned by quite a lot of people as something almost neo-colonialist. Tony Blair is active in all of this and wants to have a role in it in terms of running the place. And of course, a lot of people have said that having Tony Blair as, if you like, the proconsul or the viceroy of Gaza would not be a particularly good or productive idea, or even to have one at all, because, you know, the issue has to be in the end that Palestinians have to find a way to govern Gaza.
But who?
Well, one of the things about the resolution, it doesn't really mention the Palestinian Authority, and the language in it seems to be designed to fit in around Israeli concerns, and they want the Palestinian Authority to have, the government in Israel, want the Palestinian Authority to have no role in Gaza. And so if you don't have the so-called reformed Palestinian Authority, if that happens at some time, not in the far distant future, having a role in that, then what needs to be done, I think, more urgently, is to try to put together some kind of technocratic, non-overtly political group that would be able to gradually take on responsibilities. But, you know, there is a flaw in all of this, which is essentially that the plan was put into place, and the great thing about it was that the ceasefire, while it's ragged around the edges, is more or less holding. People are still getting killed there. Palestinians are still getting killed there, but it's more or less holding. But there is essentially now a de facto partition happening inside Gaza, where 55% of it is controlled by the Israelis, 45% of it is effectively controlled by Hamas, who have been trying to show that they are back in charge, but by putting their men on the streets, also carrying out punishment beatings on people they disagree with, or people they say and executions, people they say have collaborated with the Israelis. So it is not a process at the moment that is leading to an overall better future in Gaza, except for that very, very, very important point that the war is not going on at the moment.
Jeremy Byrne, thank you.
At 9:15, we've been telling you a little bit about this throughout the morning. We've been teasing you. Now let's find out more. The Turner Prize nominated artist David Shrigley is taking the phrase "money for old rope" to new levels. If you follow his work, you won't be surprised, perhaps. At his new exhibition in a Mayfair gallery, he's trying to sell 10 tonnes of old rope for £1 million. He gave a preview to our entertainment correspondent, Colin Patterson.
All right, ready?
Last-minute touches being applied to David Shrigley's exhibition of old rope in a Mayfair gallery.
I guess the starting point was the aphorism, money for old rope, in that you're invited to buy some old rope. And yeah, it's kind of how I make a living.
The artwork consists of 10 tonnes of old rope, making it heavier than a Tyrannosaurus rex or 2.5 hippos.
I guess I was interested in the idea that this is a thing that has no value, where its purpose has been exhausted. You can't use this rope.
David Shrigley is the artist who put a thumbs up on Trafalgar Square's fourth plinth. designed Kingsley, Partick Thistle's long-serving football mascot.
Here's your next question.
And on Monday, featured on ITV's The Chase.
In 2023, British artist David Shrigley pulped 6,000 copies of what novel, republishing them as George Orwell's 1984?
The answer was The Da Vinci Code. This exhibition is Shrigley's most ambitious work yet.
Four enormous piles of rope that are taller than me, and I'm 6'5", thereabouts. There's fisherman's rope, there's climbing rope, there's mooring rope.
The price?
The price.
£1 million.
Well, £1 million plus VAT, Colin. So if you wanted to buy it, you need to budget for 1.2.
It seems quite a lot of money.
£1 million? Well, by weight, Colin, you know, you've got 10 tonnes of contemporary art. And by weight, I think it represents excellent value.
The ropes were collected from all round the south of England.
Go on, show me around the rest of the gallery.
We've just seen the first pile of rope. We're walking over now to the second pile of rope. You'll see there's a bit of variety here. There's some clean rope. There's some dirty rope. The most important thing was to make sure it didn't stink of dead sea creatures. So we achieved that by bleaching it.
And the fourth room and fourth pile.
The fourth pile. I think this is the kind of denouement of the show.
In what way?
It's the end of it.
The gallery owner, Stephen Friedman, said he was happy to put Shrigley's work on sale with £1 million price tag.
Something is only worth what another person is willing to pay for it.
How confident are you it's going to sell?
I have really good ideas of who we're going to offer it to, and there's a number of museums we've talked about this work, and we're pretty confident we'll find a home for it. It could be a private collector, it could be an institution, it could be a foundation.
Do you think in years to come people will think that was a bargain?
I hope so.
And Shrigley knows where he would love the collection of old rope to find a home.
It would be nice in the foyer of a bank. That would be good, wouldn't it? Corporate art, old rope, that would be a good thing. And it will say something very positive about the banking system. And they know value for money, I'm sure. They'll appreciate the value that this represents.
Money for old rope, indeed.
Colin Patterson reporting on David Shrigley there. It's 12 minutes to nine. Another new theatre show opened last night in a huge purpose-built arena. The Hunger Games on stage began in a 1,200-seater in Canary Wharf, where there is the promise of no bad seats. The new play features John Malkovich, who appears on screen rather than on stage for every performance.
Citizens of Panem, as new voices and faces step into the spotlight, our great nation remains more united than ever. Together we ensure peace and prosperity. When the Hunger Games takes the stage, I will be watching. Will you?
He just won't be there. This is the latest such purpose-built theatre for a new show, following in the footsteps of Starlight Express in Wembley Park and the ABBA Voyage Experience that's in the purpose-built ABBA Arena in the Queen Elizabeth Olympic Park in East London. Is it the future? Out-of-town, purpose-built super theatres, these arenas. Tristan Baker is one of the producers behind Hunger Games on stage. He's the joint chief executive of Troubadour Theatres, which was behind this production, and also the aforementioned Starlight Express. And let me also welcome Sarah Crompton, the theatre critic and co-host of the What's On Stage podcast. Tristan, I'll come to you first. There'll be those who've had the experience, who've had incredible experiences. I hope it went well last night, but there'll also be those who slightly worry about this. What do you say to them?
I'm not sure why they would worry. I mean, we need more theatres. We need more entertainment. People are always looking for something new to do. And with the advent of the Elizabeth line, when you say out of town, it's not really out of town. It's all in London. It's 10 minutes from the West End when you get on the Elizabeth line. And
it depends on what you call town and where you're coming from. I mean, some of these journeys.
Exactly.
Okay, but
West End is a construct as well, isn't it? Because
yes.
The West End is all over London. So it's a way to give audiences something that they wouldn't necessarily be able to see. We've got, as you said, John Malkovich 20 meters high. We've got chariots on fire flying through the air. The seating banks are actually able to move. So the audience are in the seats and they move during the show, throughout key elements of the show.
Have you got enough women's toilets?
Well, we have 79 toilets in the building, so you do not queue. There is toilets on every floor.
Key question on many levels. Let me bring
Yes,
Sarah.
Yes, exactly. It's the main question.
Sarah Crompton, to get to the art then, to get to the work. what do you make of this trend?
I think it is to be encouraged. I mean, I can't say, as somebody who loves the arts, that it's ever a bad thing to have a new venue for people to experience it. It does create a certain type of art. You know, you are very reliant on the spectacle. But I was impressed last night at the Troubadour how it is really true that there isn't a bad seat. I mean, because you are all looking down on effectively an arena. And you really can see everything, and they do make the most of those spectacular effects, which are all good fun. You know, it's very entertaining. I wouldn't say it's quite as emotionally engaging, perhaps, as sitting in a small black box theatre where you're 5 feet from the action. But I do think that it's, you know, it's a good thing to have at the heart of a commercial development, such as commercial work, Canary Wharf, a commercial theatre. I mean, I think it's good.
And Tristan, to that point about it makes different kinds of art, what has been your thinking on that when designing this?
Well, we've designed the theatre for the audience and for the audience experience. And then because it is a large blank canvas, it allows a creative team to dream of things that they potentially wouldn't be able to do. So we have the largest hydraulic lift in London that brings a massive train and a cornucopia through the floor. And you just can't do that in a beautiful Victorian building that was built hundreds of years ago without a pit. So there's lots of things that are achievable for a creative team, for the creators and for the directors and for the writers and designers. And so it gives them a blank canvas, as well as Sarah rightly points out, the audience can come and there's not a bad seat in the house, and you're only ever 10 rows from the action with, in this case, actors flying over your head. Yes. Fighting going on the seats around you, all sorts of surprises. You're not part of the show, but you're certainly immersed in it, which I don't think you get in potentially other spaces.
Sarah, what about that intimacy point as well, though, and the feeling of being in it in a slightly different way, which the theatre is? I suppose this is the idea of bringing together some of the learnings from television and movie towards theatre, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think, like everything, you know, as technological developments happen, theatre moves on. You know, the Bridge, which is another modern theatre, recently dropped its hydraulic to create a swimming pool in the middle of an Ibsen play, which, you know, was quite surprising.
They've been doing that in the Blackpool Tower for a long time, I have to tell you, having just visited the circus. But carry on.
Yeah, well, I know, but you wouldn't expect it in Ibsen necessarily.
I've got to give a shout out to the Northwest here. Yeah, go on.
But I do think, you know, that there will be a balance struck. I would say at the moment that these spectaculars are exactly that. They are spectaculars. They're a bit like Blackpool Tower. They are enormous fun. I think it's hard not to enjoy yourself in these experiences. But whether they will gradually find ways of deepening the experience. I think this is written by Conor McPherson, whose play The Weir, which is in a proscenium arch theatre at the moment, is probably the most moving, intimate experience you can have in a London theatre. But it is difficult to see it from the seats at the top. So all these things are like balancing acts. And I do feel that as the technology develops, so will the writing, so that people get to grips with actually writing for those kinds of spaces, which I'm not sure is exactly there at the moment.
Sarah Crompton, theatre critic. Tristan Baker, one of the producers behind The Hunger Games, just opened Hunger Games on Stage. Good luck with it. Thank you very much to both of you.
And at 5 to 9, just to say, coming up on Radio 4 in a few minutes now, Melvyn Bragg's going to be selecting another of his favourite programmes from the In Our Time archives. Today he is unearthing the ancient world of feathered dinosaurs. That is coming up just after 9. Now, let us turn to the second annual UK and Ireland TikTok Awards, because they are particularly interesting this year, because the nominees contain some unexpected entries, including Friends of the Elm Tree Inn, a group of Dorset residents whose social media campaign has raised money to save an historic local pub. And they've done it all on TikTok, and I can give you a snippet now of one of their viral videos.
We've been feeling salty about our village pub closing down.
We might be Dululu, but we're trying to save our pub from being knocked down, along with its rich 400-year history.
Our pub has so much riz, and here's why.
Spill the tea!
Well, that is nominated for Video of the Year Award. And Tim Warren, who is 68, I don't think he'll mind me saying, and his daughter Sarah, who is considerably younger, are both on the line. Morning to you both.
Good morning, Justin.
Nice to talk to you. Hi, Sarah. Sarah, you wrote it, did you?
I did, yeah. I wrote the script alongside my parents in our kitchen.
And Tim, you are a performer. Did you, when you started doing it, did you think instantly, "Ooh, this could actually take off," or were you bemused by it, or what?
No, I did not think it would take off. I thought it might attract a few people, a few pounds of donations, but nothing like what it did.
And what has it done for you? I mean, the extent to which it's taken off, obviously financially, is part of it, but also just in terms of people knowing about it.
It's saved our pub, basically. The pub closed. There was no chance of it selling, it seemed. And the village were worried it was going to end up being redeveloped. And they approached the owner, who said, "Yep, the asking price is £600,000. I'll give you 6 months if you want to buy it off me." So the village formed a committee and they did an amazing job. And the village stumped up £300,000, which is half the asking price. And people don't have that sort of money lying around. It's usually earmarked for something. But we had another £300,000 to raise, and we were organising a concert in the church involving a ukulele band and some retired men of the sea singing sea shanties, and they're called the Dorset Rex, funnily enough. And our daughter came home from America, and she said, "How are you going to raise the other £300,000? I think we ought to hand over to her.
Sarah?
Yeah, and I'd basically seen some funny Gen Z content on TikTok, and I was like, why don't we just like get some villagers together and make a funny video, put it on TikTok, and if it doesn't work out, doesn't matter, but it will just be fun to do it. And then like 48 hours later, we were getting 100,000 views every hour.
Because that's the amazing thing, isn't it, about TikTok? If it happens, it happens pretty quickly. Tell us about the conversations you then had with your dad.
I mean, we couldn't really believe it, and we didn't really have the link set up properly to keep up with the traffic. So there was a lot of panicking and a lot of like setting up the crowdfunder and making sure everything was easy for people to find and donate. But yeah, we were just like so excited and so happy about it. And so was everyone else in the village.
And Tim, a final thought about the pub. You say it's been rescued. Is it imminent? When's it going to open again? Because it had